the mistakes that self-taught many painters make.
Every single painter has a different way or approach.
Expectation doesn't always meet reality.
It's more about the spectacle of the whole army rather than the individual.
Why am I limiting myself to painting that way when there's no rules?
I think if you can combine those two things and synergize them together in the way that your mindset is, you'll have massive gains when it comes to your execution models.
Well, this week we've got Paul on the show again because everyone decided that they was going to get really, really ill like the day before filming. So cheers for that.
Excuse me, I've been getting my best Grey Knight on and fighting Nurgle for the last couple of days. Like I beat this thing in like a day or two, so I'm quite happy with that. I do apologise for anyone watching or listening. I have the best Phoebe voice on from Friends, if anyone gets that analogy. But
Joe did not. Joe did not succumb to the same fate. So,
no.
Worry, Joe, if you're listening, I know you are. We've got your favourite substitute.
That's it. I have once again been wheeled out of the darkness and born unto the light.
Paul is back again, like Slim Shady, but the 40k edition.
Yeah.
So, it's been good.
I'm stunned that on the episode with Peachy last week, you dropped the most ridiculous sentence I've ever heard in my life of the DeWalt sniper. And yet, somehow, he always manages to do this. James will say something absolutely insane, and the listeners, for some reason, will all band behind him.
I'd just like to take a moment to apologise to absolutely nobody who uses a pin vise. The DeWalt sniper does not do anything but use a power tool for barrel drilling. One hole, one drill every time. So,
is that like the tagline? Like that's his superhero tagline.
A sniper is one shot, one kill. So one hole, one drill kind of works.
Well, if you've got one hole, you don't need the drill because you've already got the hole.
No,
you mean one drill, one hole.
No, because you use the muzzle brake. It's already a hole. So
let's put me in my place, isn't it?
All I
can think of when you said about using the drill to do a barrel is slipping and drilling straight through your finger.
Well,
which I have
done.
You
spend a lot of time around Ad when I converted him to the power of electricity and he has never looked back.
So, my favorite thing was in our company Slack channel, we had artists.
That was amazing.
Someone sent in it was like a JCB like digger drill and they was like just on my way to drill my weapon
doing
barrels.
Some barrels.
It's the best. That I've got to give it to Ben who done that because that made me laugh quite a lot. That was brilliant. I was feeling quite bad on Friday and he did make me laugh. So yeah. All I was going to say is thank you to all the listeners and viewers of the show for rallying behind the power of electricity.
Literally no one.
And just
it was like six people. He's acting like he's starting.
Oh, it's gone up since then. It's about 10 now because I've been checking the comments religiously. So
27,000 odd views on YouTube that episode, and James is like six people banding behind him.
Look, I can only base it upon the comments, and the comments were completely in favour of the drill. So
perhaps suggest doing it the traditional way first before you go straight.
I did
to the
put a caveat tools. In the episode. Yeah. I did say, and I just you can go back and say I did caveat. Like if you do use it for the first time and you have issues,
it's like drilling through your finger.
It's not my fault.
That's an issue.
We're not responsible for any personal injury.
No, unfortunately not. But no, yeah, lots of people. It was really heartening to see so many people that do use it. And we had a bit of a conversation in office because. I know George at the time was like, oh, it's either all full or nothing. But I grabbed the drill from Adam's room and showed George in real time. You can control the trigger on the drill.
Wouldn't it be simpler to use, you can get the little Dremel things and put a drill bit into that?
Well, actually, one thing that a lot of people suggested was this product called the Wow Stick, which I've not used, but I've seen online. I'm aware that it's a popular tool.
Wow Stick.
It's basically like an electric screwdriver, but it's got an adapter to have a drill bit.
It's a drill with stabilizers, basically.
Something that's easier to handle than
But personally, maybe I'm just the weird guy, but I have not found it that arduous to just sit there and do that.
No, I mean, I have got the little tiny needle drills and I have snapped a couple off in the model.
With respect, your amount of barrel drilling is not very much, George. Let's be honest. With the five models he done last year, and then the six models that he's done this year.
Let's back this up. I paint a lot of models. I paint a lot of armies. They just don't happen to be for myself. They happen to be for commissions. I've drilled many a barrel in my time.
Well, either way, the power of electricity won that argument, and I'm pleased for everybody who uses a drill. You know. So, yeah.
I love that he thinks he won. He's like,
I know, yes, it's like some sort of small victory.
Another victory for the Dewalt sniper.
I was vindicated in the comments. So
this is your paint a sprue moment, isn't
this
it?
This is my paint a sprue moment. Yeah.
Dewalt drill.
Yeah. I still think that's one of the best hobby hacks we've done, though, Paul.
Use a drill?
No, the sprue. The sprue was a brilliant one.
For the listeners who might not have caught a previous episode where we had Paul on, he dropped the knowledge bomb of using leftover sprues to practice your edge highlighting. And the listeners, that was a movement, James. They were flocking to that one.
It's you wait until the next hack. We're using a potato. I'm not going to reveal at the moment. You'll have to wait till the end of the episode for that. So, yeah.
Okay. So to practice drilling?
No, I can't tell you.
Wait till the end of the episode. Okay. Well, we've had a few guests on, actually, in the last couple of weeks. We had Liam Dempsey on. We had Peachy as well last week.
Yeah, I'm glad I get to follow on after Peachy.
When you first came on, the people watching and people listening were raving, Paul. So like, we had to get you back on.
What I do, I suppose.
I mean, it was a convenient situation that both Joe and myself have been at door's death with obviously the Nurgle infestation we've been fighting.
Yeah.
Actually, this is actually 4D chess. This is a part of a bigger, grander scheme to get Paul to replace Joe on the show.
Just want to say, Joe, I didn't say that. Just so you're aware. I'm not ganging up on you. They are.
So, I am.
I hope you feel better, Joe.
Yeah. But it's been really good to have both Liam on and Peachy, just obviously to completely different perspectives to the way that they approach miniature painting. I think there's a lot of take homes from both of those episodes for different purposes. Obviously, Liam's approach to obviously not looking at social media. Peachy's approach to obviously just painting and being that kind of like building block for a lot of painters that start out in with miniature painting. And the thing that really happened for me was like, When he compared it to DIY, and it's like you don't see videos of people that using a screwdriver or how to use a screwdriver or how to use a drill, no plug.
A lot of assumed knowledge.
So that was a really good, and it really, for me, I was like, do you know what? You're actually right. And like, again, his approach for doing the content that he's doing and the way that he's approaching sort of like miniature painting guides and stuff is really good because it's right for that base level that does exactly the comparison to what he was suggesting about the drill or the screwdriver or how to measure a thing for a door or whatever it was you were saying. But yeah.
And actually, I think you, a lot of newer people to like, you need that. Because I'm quite a visual learner. So like, you get these, some tutorials and things, they sort of, you think, well, you've missed a step there. You've told me how to do that. And now you're showing me the end product. How did you apply what you've told me to do to get to that point? Which is, I quite like the way of explanation, demonstration, and then imitation. So things are explained to you, they then demonstrate what they've explained to you, and then you get the chance to have a go at it yourself. And that's a good way of learning to do something.
Yeah, I really like that.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's kind of opened my eyes a little bit as well, because as someone who's always trying to push my painting to higher and higher standards, it's kind of going to make me a bit more cautious with the like assumed knowledge thing. It's kind of opened my eyes a little bit when helping other people out.
Yeah. That's why they would say that no question is a stupid like a one. Stupid
no,
question.
No, definitely not. Yeah. Definitely not.
Because just because you know the answer doesn't mean everybody else does.
I think we're fortunate actually in this hobby that there is, generally speaking, quite a good community approach.
There is,
There is. I don't really ever see people like putting a question in unless they're a bit cautious about asking those questions, but I don't really ever see someone asking the question. You always see people going, oh, you know, what would people recommend for this? I've never done this before, what's the best approach? A lot of people rally around and help, which I think is obviously just a good thing. It just shows the type of industry and type of community that we got, which is great.
Yeah. Okay. It's been a while since it's been sans guest. So what have the hobby updates been for the past, well, I guess, 3 weeks?
I haven't done much, being honest. I've been pretty busy with work. There's lots of things going on that I've kind of kept me a bit busy.
You've done the Callis and Toll preview for GW?
I did actually, yeah. To be fair, I did. That was a bit of a... I saw that model, fell in love with it, and I was like, I have to paint that model because I enjoyed it. I did set myself a little bit of a challenge, I'll be honest.
Some would say challenge, some would say delusional expectations.
Yeah.
All I'm going to say...
He's got 30 tanks to paint yet, so...
All I'm going to say is I did it. So I took it home...
No. You did it. Yeah, fair enough. You did do it late.
Late, mid-morning, not 9 a.m. I mean, like, it's all a bit vague. Like,
it's all relevant.
It's all relevant, yeah.
Yeah, it's all, you know.
But I think the thing is, yeah, so I took it home the evening before at 5 o'clock or 5:30 when we finished the office, and it was bare plastic built, and it came in the next morning, I think it was about 10:30, fully painted and done. So I don't think...
Yeah, that's not bad.
I don't think... I got it, and there was no major painting in the morning. It was only a couple of little bits that I just wanted to sort out on it. But yeah, I was quite happy with that. Like I said,
on your desk with all the paints set up.
Yeah, I had a bit of a thing where I was like, I think it was one of the previous episodes where it was like, you know, I do like a challenge. So like I took it home thinking, right, yeah, I'm going to try and get it painted and get it done in time. One thing I really did actually want to do with it as well is, because Adam painted the other two characters, he painted, I can't remember what her name is, but Cat Lady, I'm just going to call her that.
I'm sure that's what it says on the box, yeah, Cat Lady.
Yeah, official.
Yeah. I'd done this awesome purple cat with her, which is great. But the overall vibe that we spoke with Adam and spoke about what we want to do with them is, yeah, copy and box art would have been great, but I think I look at those sort of like Vampire Hunter models from Age of Sigmar or from that game, and I just see them as Inquisition. They just look like Inquisition to me. So what we wanted...
The hats.
Yeah. What we wanted to do was basically wrap them in kind of Inquisitional colours. So like dark reds, maroons, blacks, you know, with like blue, cold kind of highlights and stuff like that. And then, yeah, so I'd done those two models, the Cat Lady and the other one that's got the torch and the sword. I can't remember their name, being frank.
Well, it's Callus and Toll. So he's one of them. I think
it's Toll. Cat Lady and Torch Man.
That's perfect. There we go. Cat Lady and Torch Man. I'd done a great job on those. And then, yeah, I'd done Dual Pistol Guy.
Sorry to any AOS fans. Yeah. This is really helpful.
You can correct me really in the helpful. Comments. Hey, look, I'm ill. All right. Okay. I'm still fighting Nurgle.
Different game system.
Nurgle's in
Age of Sigmar. What do you want about it? No, touche.
Touche. Serve that one right back at you like a henman. Yeah, so I massively enjoyed it. I just wanted to paint that model. For the moment I saw it, I really just thought, yeah, it's a phenomenal model. The pose was great. It's a little bit tricky to paint, actually, because obviously I built it a single piece and then had both the arms where they're right in front of him. So the access was a bit difficult on the front, but it's great. He's got this really cool kind of like, almost like, I don't know what type of, it's like a padded kind of like armored kind of like part on the lower portion of the body, which was really cool. And I used red for that, which was great. And then just done like purple. There's a little gem that I didn't even realize the model had until I had it in hand to paint it. It's got this little kind of like gem on just on like one of the lapels here. So I painted that in purple as well, which I thought worked quite nicely with the red and stuff. So yeah, it was real fun model to paint. I had a blast of it.
I'll ask. Well, I won't ask how many you've painted because that's a waste of time. How many tanks have you bought since we last spoke?
Yeah, next question.
Well, actually, since we last spoke,
not been that.
I don't think any more have arrived.
No, it hasn't. No,
that you know of, Paul. No more have arrived at the office.
Yeah.
No, there are no more. Like we're at max.
Stuff still arrives at the office.
We're at max capacity now. Like regarding tanks. Yeah. Like,
go on, what's the count?
I don't know. I genuinely don't know.
Scary.
I'm pretty sure the most recent tank that I saw him buy was at Warbloop. Was it Warbloop that you got
one? Oh yeah, I got a Demolisher,
We went there obviously to sell stuff at Warbloop.
And James bought stuff.
James buys stuff. Yeah. He's there buying things.
Yeah, I was just getting rid of some Grey Shame and buying some more.
I've got someone else's.
One tank. Just one tank. So
it's a big Grey Shame swap.
Yeah. It's a swap meet. That's what it is then.
It's fine. No, I don't know how bad it is, but I have now decided that is it. For tanks, so we're done. We've got full everything I need for tanks is done.
There's going to be some other parts.
Can't wait to roll this back in a few months and see you say that.
There's been a lot of random little parts appearing. So four tanks, tracks.
Yeah, a couple of extra tracks. Well, those tracks are for the main part of the main sort of jewel in the crown, if you want to put it anyway, of the Mordian army, which is an old Forge World Baneblade. So I bought one. It's a great kit. It needs some work. If anyone's watching that gets into car sort of repairs from Husking Hulk to a brand new repaired vehicle if they're interested.
Miniature
in.
Tank restoration.
Yeah, yeah.
It'll be like those videos on, do you ever see those like obviously fake videos on YouTube where they'll get like an old Hot Wheels car that looks like it's been under the sea for 35 years?
Yeah.
And then they'll make it pristine. James likes to do that with a Lemon Russ. So.
Yeah, yeah. This Baneblade is something that I always wanted back in the day and I never could get one. And I just couldn't afford to get one and I couldn't get one. And one became available and I was just like, right, yeah, I have to have that. Because it fits really well with Mordian. So.
Paul,
so,
you've done a you finished your Harbinger of Decay.
I did. Yeah. I finally managed to finish it.
It looks amazing.
So
it does look sick.
I was quite happy with that, I must admit. Absolutely, it was it's like I said to George, it was one of those, you have that sort of miniature where you think you, or I think I was saying to you as well, it was something finally clicks into place and it's almost like you've taken another step up in the painting journey or whatever you want to call it, you know, where you sort of,
it's one where you look back and you're like, that was the one.
Yeah, that's kind of, things have gotten better there at that point. Something's happened there and things have come together. Compared to my other stuff, it makes me want to throw my other things away.
Don't do it.
Because I'm not going to. But it's quite nice because I keep looking at them and thinking. And also, that Harbinger's now sat on my shelf. And every time I walk past, I go, I painted that. Nice. I painted that.
Definitely.
I also recently got my dad onto WhatsApp so I could send him pictures. And we had this quite nice little thing where, you know, he's 70, but he's still my dad. And I showed him the pictures and he's, oh, that's really good. You know, you should enter that into a competition. He said, it'd be fantastic. He said, it's really good. And, you know, it's like, he's still my dad and he still likes the artwork that I do every now and again, you know.
That's a nice moment.
But I'm still quite happy with that. And I keep looking at it and thinking, that's I'm happy with that. And it's quite nice.
You smashed it. It's really, really good. It's always good when you have a model that you can see tangible like jumps in progress in sort of like the way you paint it, the way that it finishes. Even like a technique perhaps that you've done previously on multiple models, but seeing it culminate in like the best version of the way you've done it on that model.
I painted that so differently to the way that I painted anything else before it. And it's just such a difference.
Do you want to unpack that? Like what was it that was different?
Well, like last time I see you, it was sort of saying about relying on contrast paints and, you know, that sort of thing. Whereas with the Harbinger, I didn't do any of that. I painted, I want to say properly, but I thinned my paints properly. I sort of tackled each piece systematically rather than doing a bit of this and doing a bit of that and then forgetting where I was with that bit and trying to, you know, get back into the flow of things. I painted when I wanted to paint because I think that's quite important for me. If I sit down at a table and I'm not really interested in doing it, I paint a lot worse.
You can tell he's been listening to the show, can't you?
On a Friday when I do my painting, I have the podcast on. But, you know, and so it's like the other day, obviously with what I'm painting at the minute, over the weekend, I really wasn't interested in painting at all. Mm-hmm. And I sat down to paint. And I did paint, but I wasn't happy with it in the end. So I stripped the model and I started to get, like yesterday on the way at 8 o'clock in the morning, this is like 45 minutes before I have to sort of leave the house for work. Suddenly I was in the mood for painting. So I sat down and I repainted what I'd done over the weekend and it's 100 times better.
Yeah.
And that's just because of my mindset. I was in the right place at that particular time.
It really shows how important the mood and the mindset to painting actually is. I think it's something that we've spoken about it before many a time, but it's something we get asked about all the time. But like, it really shows how important that actually is about the execution of painting miniatures.
It's not just the enjoyment either. It's like the results are, like you said, obviously drastically different.
You know, just forcing yourself to do something is never good.
Yeah.
Especially if you're not really interested in doing it at that particular point. So, I mean, and also I think I didn't rely on washes so much to shade like the fabrics on that Harbinger and things like that. I did use some shading paints from Citadel, but far less than I would normally sort of lean on them.
So what did you do? Did you just dilute down
just massively
sort of darker?
Like kind of making your own washes, or was you treating it more?
I did
like
make a few
glazing?
Of my own washes rather than just relying on Agrax or Nuln Oil to do everything for me. I think it's just the process of thinking about what I'm doing for a change, rather than sort of just going with the flow. Right, I've painted this, let's whack some Nolan oil on it. That's that shaded. Now I can move on. Whereas with the Harbinger, it's actually, you know, trying to use the correct paints on each part, you know, do some proper highlighting, sort of line highlighting, and water my paints down so they actually flowed off my brush properly.
That leans into the like critical thinking that we've spoke about before, where like thinking about why you're making the choices you're making and all rather than just doing it because you feel like you're supposed to, or it's like, it seems like the next logical step.
And also, for the sake of it. I mean, sure, I made mistakes on it. It's not perfect. I can learn from those sort of mistakes. I know what I did wrong. I know how to correct what I've done wrong on it. And of course, that's just going to hopefully set me up for the next one. But I seem to go through this phase where I don't know if anyone else does this, but I go through a bit of a phase where I do 3 or 4 really awesome models. And then the next one I do, I feel like I'm painting the same way that I did before, but it just doesn't turn out right. Could that
be that you're perhaps experimenting with different colours or things that you've not used before? So even though what you're hoping to the way you're trying to finish it and render the model is the way in line with the way you've done previous models.
Sometimes, sure.
It could be new paints. Just...
At the moment, I'm now sort of at this point where all I want to do is experiment with things. So, of course, things don't look the same as they did the last model because I'm experimenting with all these. Now that I've done this, I think, why am I limiting myself to painting that way when there's no rules? There's no rules to paint. You can paint, you know, experiment. So that's what I'm doing. But, you know, trying to expect the same results as I painted before is not going to happen. So, I was really happy with that Harbinger. It came out really well.
Yeah, it's awesome. Great.
Sweet. As artists, we know how time-consuming painting miniatures is, especially if you want to achieve a high standard for tabletop or display. Life is busy, and we don't all have 8 hours a day to paint. Plus, if you're still early in your painting journey, it may feel that you're a long way off ever owning your own beautiful army for your games. For 10 years, Siege Studios has been delivering bespoke miniature painting commissions to collectors and gamers all over the world. We have a world-class team of artists from Golden Demon winners to ex-studio painters, collating hundreds of years of collective experience. Here at Siege, we offer a series of painting levels and services to meet your needs and budget, whether you want a favorite character for your display or a stunning gaming army. We pride ourselves on offering well above the industry standard of quality and our customer experience. To see our gallery, learn more about our services, and get a quote now, head over to siegestudios.co.uk or head to the link in this episode's description.
Cool. Should we do some a staple of the show, our listeners' comments? It's been a while. Let's go through some of these here. Mr. Lee says, the tanks on bases thing is tough. I put an orc truck on one of the newer buggy bases and it really set it off, but a rhino would look weird. I think it has a lot to do with negative space on a model and how much detail you can fit around it. So that's in relation to when we had Peachy on the show. We were speaking about why tanks don't have bases always, although some of the new ones do, confusingly, I guess, because they're flying.
Because they hover, don't
they? Yeah.
But I sort of made the argument that you can kind of turn it into like sort of a mini diorama or something. I think it's quite a
depends
fun
what
idea.
You want to do. I think for the most part, it's personal taste. I think if you're playing games and things, keep them off the bases. Just for, you know, it's easier. If you've got terrain all over the place, maybe it's easier to place them down on your gaming board and things. But if you're going to like make it a bit of a diorama or whatever.
I guess that's part of the issue because I don't play the games. I never really think about the consequences that some of those things would have. But I guess visually it intrigues me. I don't mean in the sense of like making a massive diorama, but you can just add like just a little bit.
Yeah.
Like I really love the new Cadians got the filled ordnance battery and it's literally just a little artillery cannon, but it's almost, it's not a diorama, but it's like got that diorama vibe because there's like,
You could easily carry on that theme.
Yeah, exactly. Because you've got the little guys on there loading the shells in. You've got the guy like looking at the recon or whatever. It's quite cool. It's got like visual interest.
Yeah.
And there's so you see that like within some of the larger vehicles as well. Like we've recently done some commissions for some orc vehicles.
Mm.
And like the kill rig is basically like a Mad Max diorama like going on, you know.
Yeah.
So I quite like that. I'd like the idea of if I did have like a rhino or something, which is, let's be honest, quite a plain, bland-ish model, having it on a little base where like maybe like, oh, one of the tracks is coming off, or there's like guy like
mechanic working on it, or maybe like even some dead soldiers that are getting like run over by the tanks. I felt that'd be quite cool.
As much as I agree with everything you've just said, it still for me just looks odd, and I don't know why it is. It shouldn't do, and I just want to categorically say that. Like,
do you think that's just because you're used to not seeing them?
I genuinely think that's the reason why. Like, genuinely think, because I've known Rhino, Razorback, Predator, Land Raider, Vindicator, I've known all those tanks, like Rust, all of them. I know all of them to always never have a base.
Yeah.
The moment that I see, like I think I've mentioned in that episode, the first time I saw a Rhino on a base, I was like,
what's that?
What? That just looks weird. Like, you know, I'm not disagreeing in the slightest, because I think that the base gives you, as you said, like the perfect opportunity to
add
create
a bit more story.
Yeah, exactly. Add, and that, you know, I love story when it comes to 40K. I think it adds a massive amount of value to the miniatures.
And you've spoken before about how you love basing for adding.
I do love basing, but there's something for me that when I see a tank on a base, it's really weird. Like, I this is why I think it's really confusing, and I don't actually think I've got to the point where I can understand why. Other than it just looks odd to me because of what I've known for such a long time.
Yeah.
If I look at like a Gladiator, or if I look at a Repulsor, or if I look at any of those tanks, and I see that, it makes sense, because I think since the moment I saw that tank, it's had a base. And I've been like, oh yeah, it's obviously it's flying, so it's got a base. You know,
have a base. Yeah.
But for me, I don't know. It's really weird. Not that I've played games in a long time, but when you're looking at your army on the table. Obviously, your infantry have bases, and that's just how they've always had bases or whatever. But then when you just look at your tanks and they're just on the table, that's kind of how they would look in real life. Does that make sense?
But there's a continuity thing here, because this comment even mentions, like with the orcs, like with the newer orc buggies and stuff, they have the bases. And I painted orcs as a Cult of Speed, I think. Army, and that was like all the newer stuff, and it was the bikes, and everything was on a base, and it just looked quite nice because everything had it's that consistent. Uniformity. Yeah.
But then you're talking about that job with that kill rig in it recently, like that had one of the, not the, the gargantuan, it had the smaller squig off. That doesn't have a base.
Yeah.
So you've got vehicles and stuff in that army that
and obviously there's got to be a line somewhere.
But then
confusingly, knights have got a massive base.
Exactly. Yeah.
But I suppose if you look at model making, even traditionally, most figures come on a base, and most tank model kits never have come on a base.
Yeah.
You know, maybe there's a bit of that involved, but I think I don't know, part of me would quite like to see a Rhino, you know, smashing through some sort of
barricade
wall, you know, sandbags going everywhere.
You know what, I'm doing a Blood Angels army. I'll lay this out. I'm gonna give it a go. If I get any tanks.
Ooh, you madman.
Put tanks on base.
I'll storm that beach.
Yeah
Like for me just I don't know what it is. It's like, because I suppose you're used to the silhouette of a model for X amount of years from looking at it. The moment that silhouette is changed,
it just
no matter how
break that mold. Okay, let's do another one. Untitled name says, lots of novice painters are quite insecure about their paint jobs in the local game store. They are hyped that it's painted or whatnot, but hesitant to show it off, or they make excuses for it as you're looking at it. This type of person needs more content made for them. They need to see mistakes and lower standards of paint jobs that Peachy presents, for example. It gives people confidence to get better.
I totally agree with that. I do it. When I, you know, James says, oh, you bring it in. I'm hesitant to bring things in that I've painted because, you know, I just think, right, I'll bring it in. And then as soon as you're looking at it, I'll start making excuses for, I didn't paint that bit, or I didn't have enough time, or this.
I think that scales though, because you say that, but we almost do the same thing to each other.
Yeah.
So like me and James are quite used to painting like display competition level stuff. Mm. But I know full well that when I show James stuff and when James shows me stuff, the first thing we do when we hand it to each other is we start making excuses.
Why do we do that?
Well, I think it's because ultimately,
I know we're our own worst critics.
But I think it's because you wish that you'd either A, had the time, or B, put the effort maybe into that specific part, or for lack of time or whatever, blah, blah. Like, I think that's something that...
You want to like diminish the mistakes almost by acknowledging them before they get a chance to
say
them.
Yeah.
Which is stupid, don't get me wrong. But I feel like that's the thought process. Is like, I don't want him to think I made a mistake. I want him to know that I know that mistake's there, so he doesn't think that I just...
He doesn't bring it up.
Yeah.
You've absolutely nailed it. That's exactly it. That is exactly it. Because you're like, oh, I know I should have done that. I just didn't, or I didn't want to, you didn't have the time to do that. Or maybe that line isn't as straight as I know it. I looked at that line when I drew it, when I put it on there, and I know I can and should have done it better. You know, that's exactly it.
Yeah. Funny little psychological game, that.
Yeah. But at the game store, if you know, if you're taking your stuff to the game store for gaming and things like that, there's a like anywhere else, there's a bunch of knowledge there.
Yeah,
you know, you can tap into that.
No, 100%. I think that what Peachy is doing with going back to him, obviously being on the show last week, like, I think that having that almost like unfiltered kind of approach to viewing the process, I think it massively alleviates that sort of like, well, it's not normal to make mistakes. Like, it's perfectly normal. Yeah.
It's more representative of reality as well.
Yeah.
Because
the
majority of people are casually consuming this stuff. Like, the high-end painters represent the minority, but they're almost making content for the majority. But they're not on the same level of expectation.
I have to say, with like YouTube tutorials, I tend to find myself when I'm sort of watching them, if I'm watching high-end painters like, you know, like Richard Gray or people, you know, like that, I don't tend to really take in too much of what they're saying. It's kind of a background thing, and it's quite nice to have that it playing in the background as I'm painting.
Why is that? Is that because you feel that you're
because
not able to
do... Because they're so high level that I tend to sort of tune it out. Whereas because, you know, they're not painting for people like me. Whereas, like you say, with Peachy and, you know, some of the other YouTubers out there where, you know, their paint jobs aren't quite Golden Demon, and they are catering for people like me who are, you know, they're not painting for competitions. They're just painting to learn the process, and they actually show you, look, well, I've made a mistake here, you know, and it's not just, well, I've seen you make a mistake and then it just cuts and that mistake's gone. How do you repair that mistake? How do you get, and they sort of say, well, we made a mistake, but don't worry about it.
I think worse than that is the not showing the mistake at all and kind of like hiding that they even happen.
Yeah.
Which is ridiculous.
It's, I mean, the painting process, you have this, you know, ugly phase, I suppose, when at the start of when you're painting, you know, any model, you have this sort of phase. I always do. I always know that I do it, but
no, 100%.
I know that, you know, I put the base colors down. I think it looks terrible. However, I know that at some point in the future, you know, a few hours time or whenever you get, it's all going to come together. But it's that process of starting, you know, in this ugly phase until it comes together that a lot of people struggle with, because you can't see past that ugly phase to know that. Keep at it and it will come together.
I think that's a combination of things we spoke about on other episodes and you know, with other people. Like, there's too much of an importance placed upon getting the progress.
Perfect.
Yeah, or getting the progress and just, you know, especially like for wanting to contribute to the anathema that is obviously Instagram and social media and all that kind of stuff and putting updates up and all that kind of stuff. Like, I think that's part of it as well. Like, it's seeing the thing at the end of the process and going, that's what I'm going to achieve, you know, or what I want to get to, but then not thinking about all the incremental steps which get you there and focus on each of those. If you focus on each of those individually, you'll get to the end. Whereas, like you say, obviously the ugly stage, and I'd agree with you, that's where obviously the model doesn't look anywhere near that end finished result. When you say ugly, it doesn't necessarily mean well painted or badly painted.
It's
more about the process or the stage in the painting. And I think too many people focus on that end goal rather than thinking, well, if I just put the red wall over the model, and then if I just block the black in, and if I just shade it all the color that it needs to, the soft shadow, and then I do the deep shadow, and then I do this for the first stage highlight, then I do, if you focus incrementally on those steps, the end of the process and the final thing almost happens.
It's more digestible as well, isn't it? Because even with like our own Patreon tutorials or with content like Peachy, because it's that more methodic step-by-step of like, if you do these steps in this order, it will look like this. Whereas, as you know, if you're painting like more competition stuff or higher-end display pieces, there's a lot more like painting as you go, kind of less repeatable, like you're sort of doing micro blends on the palette that you can't really account for them.
Been quite defeatist as well in the past. Like, you know, I've started a model and I've not got past that sort of ugly phase, that sort of point, because I can't see that end product. Sometimes it just on a model, I think that's it, I finished with that one. I can't see past this stage, and so I ditch it and start something else.
Do you, something to ask? I mean, when you start a new model that maybe you're not painted before, like you were saying, you know, you said earlier, like I'll paint something and it won't, and I've painted in a certain way and a certain quality for X amount of time, and then I'll try something new and it maybe I'm painting the same, but it doesn't reach the same. Do you think that's because of not deconstructing the end result, working almost backwards and going, well, that's what I want it to look like. And then to get that, I need to do this, 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 this. Do you think that's because of that?
Maybe, because I'm looking at the end goal rather than setting myself smaller, achievable goals to actually get there, like the stepping stones to get to the prize at the end.
One thing I will just want to tack on to that is that, like, I also think we're also saying about, like, seeing mistakes and seeing errors or seeing things that maybe don't go quite right and stuff like that. I do think it's very difficult, and I just want to defend, but I do want to see it from the other side of the fence, whereby when people are making those types of videos, be it, you know, super high end or whether it be, you know, maybe kind of just like showing a process of painting a miniature or whatever, I think there is also maintaining the interest of that person watching it, and sometimes those things can get put to the wayside because of it.
That's the difficulty of content in general, is like you're also trying to make a video that people like,
is entertaining,
watch, or that is entertaining. Yeah. And a lot of people, I mean, I know this from fact, from doing our own research and speaking to other people and from my own habits, most people who watch tutorials aren't actually necessarily going to do that exact thing. They want to watch that video for a level of entertainment and kind of like banking that information for a later date. I would say that there's quite a small minority of people that are actually searching for that specific video because they've got that exact model and they want to paint that exact thing in that exact same color scheme.
When I first started painting, the way that I got in, like, was sort of learned to do it, I bought a VHS cassette tape from the back of a wargaming magazine for painting wargaming miniatures, you know, like little.
Did that exist? That's mental.
It existed, yes.
Did it really?
No, I grew up with VHS. Yeah. I didn't know
that there was like painting content in that format.
Very, very limited. Like this was the only cassette that I could, the only like video on this process that I could find, because YouTube wasn't a thing then. Yeah. So I bought this videotape, and I must have watched that videotape 50, 60 times to learn. And it was just this elderly gentleman sat at his bay window in his house painting this dwarf. And it was just one dwarf, that was it. And it was 45 minutes, this cassette tape. And I must have watched that, like I say, tons of times. And it was so, I mean, people know when they got VHS about the tracking, trying to get the tracking right. So it was almost unviewable by the time
I'd imagine the resolution wasn't great either.
I don't know. It was okay. It was all right to watch. But that cuts the kind of content.
Could you actually see what you was learning? Because I film videos in 4K. Yeah, it wasn't too bad. You can't see what's going on.
It wasn't too bad. It was a general idea. But I mean, we are very lucky these days.
Yeah.
Very lucky that there is so much content out there to learn from.
Well, I said it last episode. I said it's like being drunk. You just see it. You're just constantly absorbing all this stuff, and it's there for you like every day because of the growth of the industry and because of the growth of individuals making content like that and the increase of that. There's something new going up every day.
Yeah.
And that's like, on most occasions, it's multiple videos. It's not just one person. There are a lot of people putting up new videos, especially when you're following the meta of like releases from manufacturers and that kind of stuff. Like, you are drowned in videos, tutorials, content, step by steps. Like, you are absolutely, like, I think someone coming into the future from 10, 15 years ago wouldn't know where to start.
Yeah.
Being frank. They'd arrive and they'd be like, I where do I even begin? Mm-hmm. If we are naturally aware of it and naturally okay with it because it's how things are now, and we've obviously grown with the industry as that's happened. I think if you had someone come from the past or do a Back to the Future doc expose, like
from the 90s
if they came forward, it'd be like, well, where do I even start?
I'm glad you said that, because that segues so perfectly into our topic for this week, which is about the mistakes that self-taught mini painters make. And number one on my list here is consuming too much content in place of practicing.
Yeah.
So just to unpack this topic before we dive into all of the specific points, this is basically mistakes that you might make if you're someone who is learning, like just from watching tuition online and you've not taken any. For example, we do like the painting classes with Siege in person, and you've not had or maybe you've been like painting or learning from a more experienced friend who's getting you into the hobby and they can have some hands-on time. Some of the little things that you're not necessarily going to know are mistakes, or some things that I've personally experienced in the past that I've overcome. Especially if you're someone who's self-taught and learning in this plethora of content online that James is referring to. Something which I massively suffered from early on. And I do this with a lot of things that I get interested in. So I picked up my first like Warhammer box because I got the idea when I was like walking past the Games Workshop store. I've told the story before. But I had that box and it was sat on my desk. And before I even opened it, I was like, I'm going to watch dozens and dozens of hours on YouTube. I'm going to learn everything. And I have this naive like thought that I'm just going to learn it all first and then
like
do
Neo
the thing.
You do,
the Matrix.
Yeah, I would say I can't remember a name from the Matrix. That's going to really bug me now.
Trinity? You do a Trinity before the helicopter scene where she just like gets all the information exactly. And like, downloads it and then she's like, I don't have to fly a helicopter. Yeah.
Yeah.
Like,
which, going to my point, is there is no replacement for actually practicing and doing things yourself. Yeah. You can't learn how to swim from watching a YouTube video. Like, it's not going to save you. Do you know
what
I mean?
Well, you can, but you might still unfortunately not be able to swim.
Yeah.
So
just go get swimming lessons. Yeah. Don't watch YouTube videos.
Yeah.
And that's not to say that you can't learn how to paint minis from watching videos online. You absolutely can. I've done it. Lots of people have done it. And there is some amazing content out there, some amazing tutorials, and you can absolutely learn a lot from them. But my personal experience, there comes a time where you kind of start using those as a bit of a crutch of procrastination.
Mm, nice.
And you start relying on watching those videos. You're like, oh, I've got an hour to paint tonight.
Yeah.
And you spend that hour watching videos, or like 45 minutes watching videos, rather than actually putting painting that repetition in.
Yeah.
I'm going to throw something else into the mix that I am actually very guilty of. And I don't know whether it's a bad thing or whether it's a good thing, but I think it's something to just to talk about as a topic. So I've not seen anyone really talk about this before. It's absorbing another style or way of actually painting. So I grew up loving heavy metal, right? I grew up loving it, eat, sleep, breathing it, as I always say.
That's heavy metal, the painting style, and not the heavy materials.
Yeah,
that
I don't just go grab a random bit of like titanium just and start chewing on it or something.
Lead.
Like that. Yeah,
brilliant.
But nice hobby. What I mean is that, like, so really, what's happened with my painting over the years is that is kind of like what I've always painted as, because like or attempting to paint it as close to that as possible. Not saying I can paint it to that standard, but painting it as close to that as I physically can. And I think one of the pities of that, of when you kind of absorb something that you see, is that you don't develop your own processes and your own ways of executing stuff. I look at a lot of painters out there that probably can paint an heavy metal style miniature, maybe not to the same refinement and quality as an heavy metal actual model, but in the same lieu of it. But they also paint in a style which is like signature to them. So you mentioned Rich, for example, or the wizard, as I call him, like, Rich has got a very unique way of painting, his way of painting. You can look at a piece and go, I know that's Rich's Rodrigo Accor. You can look at his miniatures and go, I know that's a Rodrigo Accor miniature. You can look at Mark Masclan's, look at his busts and things that he paints and go, I know that's a Mark Masclan's bust. You know, because they have their own in their own style of physically painting miniatures, if that makes sense. I think that's one of the things that, for me, I say gutted that, like, because it's not really a negative or a positive. I don't really know how to explain it, but I wanted to talk about this as a specific topic or on this episode or show, because I think it's something that maybe as a painter, you should try, and if you love a certain style, there's nothing wrong with you doing that and trying to paint that way. But at the same time, try to be a bit more creative with your own way of painting. Because at the end of the day, like we always say, it is art. Just because it's on miniatures, it's still a form of art. And how boring would it be if Monet looked at a Picasso and went, oh, I'm just going to paint like that.
If you enjoy listening to these podcast episodes every single week, I'd like to ask that you could please do us one small, tiny favor in return and hit that subscribe button on YouTube or the follow button on your podcast app. It takes only 2 seconds and it really, really helps us out. And it allows us to bring you these episodes for free every single week. Thank you so much. Back to the episode. That's funny, actually, because in fine art, everyone's trying to develop their own style and everyone's got this obsession with trying to be unique and have their own distinct look where people recognize their work just from looking at it visually. Mm. And yet it feels like, I'm sure there's plenty of people that do want their own style, and that's fair enough. But it does feel like there's this gravitation to like, oh, there's this content creator that I really want to paint like, or there's this competition painter exactly. that I really want to paint like. Yeah. I want to make my stuff look exactly like them.
Yeah. Or they're chasing the box art.
Yeah.
Images.
And I'm super, you know, guilty. I say it, like, I am guilty as charged with that. Like I love it. You know, that's the way that I love painting. But I think that's something that I've probably over the last, since doing this show and since chatting, obviously on Paint Perspective, like I think that's something that for me has always has started to be a bit more of a thing that I'm aware of. It's like, yeah, I love that and I'll always love that and I'll always try to paint like that. But maybe I should just get a model and just try and paint it in a way which I feel is right for me, if that makes sense.
Don't you think you should, but that isn't that something that maybe develops after you've got, I mean, because like Richard Gray, I mean, you could use his tutorials to learn to paint.
Yeah.
And then veer off and create your own style rather than just seeing him. Right.
There's a difficulty though, when you've been painting a certain way for so long to try and branch out. Because it kind of becomes your style because that is how you paint. Yeah. Do you know what I mean?
That's what I know.
And there's also so many little things to it. Like, for example, like, it just, and it's something we say about videos all the time. Just because you're watching the video, you don't get the exact dilution. Your water in the area that you live might not be the same as the water in the area that person lives in. So some people have got a lot of water that's got more, not chalk, but it's a bit more
hard and soft water.
Like, and inadvertently, those things do affect the way that paint behaves on a model and the way that dilution happens as well. Like painting isn't this non-granular thing that like you just add water to the paint and it behaves like X. Like there's so many little variables that, you know, and that's before we come down to using the brush. You know, some people use the brush a lot softer than others so that they're generating, again, it's something I always say on classes, like I see lots of people when they're doing brush strokes and they're painting miniatures and they're putting a base coat in a model like this and they're slapping the paint on like this. You don't visibly see it, but you're creating loads of micro friction on that surface of that miniature, which theoretically will give you a rougher finish than perhaps someone who puts it on in one pass that's smoother, if that makes sense. With where they've adjusted the pigmentation and dilution ratio so that they can do one smooth control pass, block that in with one control pass, creating less friction on the surface of the model. There's loads of little nuances in miniature painting that, because we don't visibly see it, we don't think about it.
Yeah.
And I think that's the real interesting thing. Like when you say like about like box art, you know, one thing that I've got to take my hat off to, and it is a bit of a nod towards heavy metal, and I always say this, I know I look up to them and I know I've always enjoyed their painting, but that's one thing that has always been a bit of an anathema to me, is that they have 20 plus painters in the main heavy metal team now. You've got the specialist games team, etc. But they do get their painting very, very, very at a micro level close to each other. Like
they're very consistent.
Very consistent with each
other. That's kind of by design of the style itself, though, isn't it?
Yeah, and also you have to take into consideration the internal training that goes into place, obviously, when they take someone on and being through osmosis, in that kind of environment. But the real interesting thing for me is that like all these little things that we're talking about, they do make massive tangible differences. So just because you watch a Rich video, or just because you watch a Squidmar video, or just because you watch whoever's video and you go, I really like their painting style, the choices and things that you then start making don't inherently lead to you painting exactly the same as that person.
Well, it's also like the assumption that what that person is doing is correct, which is not to say that they're incorrect, but because it is art and everyone has their own way of doing things, it might be correct for them in that moment on that given model. It might not be correct for you in your skill set and your given model. Do you know what I mean? So like you kind of have this assumption that like, oh, I saw this in a tutorial and that's how they done it, so I'm supposed to do it like that.
But and I'm going to paint every model like the same way.
Yeah. Forever. And like, I'm sure James knows from doing the classes, and I know from sitting down painting with other guys on the team, is everyone has their own way of doing stuff. And I sit and have these conversations with James about like the electric drill, for example, which is funny to joke about. But if you looked at our finished models, you wouldn't look at either of them and say that one of us had a bad drill barrel and one of us had a good drill barrel.
You'll be looking now.
Yeah. We will find the differences.
Yeah.
But everyone has their own way of getting there, don't they? So I guess like that's why I say at a certain level, like put down the content and practice and put those hours
in. I agree totally. But
I do find myself, I have to say, that on a Friday when I sit down to paint, the first thing I do is I set my iPad up next to my painting table, and I scroll through YouTube content, like paint, like the painters that I subscribe to, for something to watch or to have in the background. And I think the time's ticking away and I've not done anything yet because I'm focused on finding someone to watch.
Yeah.
To do it.
That's why I've always, I don't know why it's not something I consciously made a decision to, but like for me, I don't watch anything while I paint. It's all audio. I either put on an audio book or I put on a film score. Like podcasts
fill that gap though, because I know a lot of people listen to the show while I do, on a Friday.
This sort of whether you're watching the show on YouTube or whether you're listening to it on one of the myriad of different apps or platforms that we put it on, like or any other podcast or any other thing, like something that's non-visual, I think helps. There's this thing where like visual attention and almost situational attention are like they're separate totally. Like attention isn't just one thing in my mind. Like you can visually focus on something. Like if I'm sitting here now and I'm looking at the grain on this table, it doesn't mean that I can't listen to something that's over there. Does that make sense? Yeah. Like so, I think that you can split your attention between multiple things and do two things at once, etc. But for me, it's the blurring of visual and situational.
It does depend on the visual. For example, like if you've got a podcast on, I like to watch podcasts while I'm painting.
Yeah.
But you know, it's like in this context, this guy's sitting having a chat. It's not like something that I need to divert my attention.
Exactly. Yeah. Like if I had a miniature on screen and I was talking about it, and that's going to trigger you to look at the screen and then look at it, etc. Yeah. Blah blah. There's probably people listening now that have just looked at the screen. But the point is that I think that those two types of attention, I think learning to separate those and not do the thing, I'm sorry to call you out on it, but put something on that isn't the visual will help you to then focus on the visual for yourself and go, right, okay, well, I'm doing this. And you'll probably be able to start painting a lot quicker while just listening to the thing.
Yeah.
I'm sure you do this as well, Paul. Like I'll sit there because I do the same thing. I literally have my iPad sat on my hobby desk. And I'll spend like 15 minutes trying to find like the perfect video for the background. Yeah. And I wasted all that time. Like you could have been painting.
Yeah, even when I'm sort of mid-painting, the video will finish. I put the paintbrush in my mouth, you know, like the handle, so it's, you know, sideways. I've got paint on the end. So now I'm scrolling.
You're on a time crunch now.
That's drying.
I've got paint drying on my brush. It's like, and then I go and I think, what am I doing?
I will happily and guiltily admit that I have killed a near brand new Kolinsky brush
because
I had my iPad there and I was painting and I stopped for a second to click on another video and I got distracted and it just literally dried out beyond repair.
It
doesn't happen often, but I mean, I do it. I'm guilty of doing that. I mean, on a Friday, I normally listen to obviously the Siege podcast.
Paint Perspective.
Yeah. So I normally listen to that on a Friday, and then after that, it depends. I either go straight to the tutorials or even worse, I get Netflix on where you're compelled to watch.
Now we're on a slippery slope.
You know, and you're compelled to watch that.
When you spend 15 hours trying to decide on what to actually watch.
Peachy last week said that he, on his ideal hobby day, he would have something on in the background like Lord of the Rings or the Hobbit movies.
Yeah.
And his whole thing for that was because he's seen them before and he doesn't have to look at them. That's the thing
because that has almost become like the podcast whereby you just don't need to watch it because you know every scene, every word.
I mean, I feel though, I can't just sit there in silence and paint.
No, I definitely agree.
To have some background noise.
Oh, you know, this is where I'm a bit 50-50 on it. Like there have been certain times when I've been painting something, not just necessarily for competition, but there's many occasions where I've just been like, I really need to focus on this. And like having that quietness and having nothing going on other than the absolute focus of the thing I'm doing has been really therapeutic, as in like just not being distracted by anything at all whatsoever.
I mean, it's beyond the scope of this podcast because it's a painting podcast, but I will draw a comparison. I think it was Andrew Huberman who was saying like being comfortable, being uncomfortable. And he was saying like, have you ever gone for like just a walk without putting headphones on and just being alone with your own thoughts? And I tried applying that to painting. It's similar to what James is saying. When I was painting for Golden Demon, I made a conscious decision to like have no distractions because I was really trying to put myself in the right headspace. Mm. And it's funny how you paint very, very differently when you haven't got that, because it's still sucking away like 10% of your attention, even if it's not like your full visual attention. Like that's still, your brain is still trying to process what you're listening to. And just having like full 100% of like your own independency in what you're thinking, and you're thinking about what you're doing more consciously. Like you've got a bit more bandwidth to start thinking about, okay, I'm going to do this next. And you can start like planning ahead. And you, even though it's only a small amount of attention that you're winning back,
Well, it sounds like nothing, but it's still your attention is still mitigated in some form. Like if I think the ultimate thing is like, let's just say hypothetically, you do have it. I don't want to, there are a lot of people that watch this and listen to this that maybe aren't interested in competitions, and I don't want to go down that rabbit hole for too long and bore people. But all I would say is that if you really tried your hardest to enter for a competition and you can honestly sit there and say, I gave it 100%. Does that include all the little distractions while you're painting?
Yeah.
If you're sitting there and you're going, I gave it 100%, and I didn't have any distractions while I was doing that at all, you can confidently sit back and go, that's the best I can do.
Yeah.
You know, but if you've got random stuff going on, and we've all got busy lives, like, don't get me wrong, like, I'm not sitting here like, but saying that you can't have distractions. But I think that when you get the opportunity to just completely zone in on a model and zone in 100% and give it absolutely categorically 100%, you will see better results.
I think it's subjective. I do think it's worth a go. But I will acknowledge that this is entirely like personal preference, and it's down to you.
Yeah.
And I know that there's a lot of people who, particularly if you've got, if you're neurodivergent or you've got ADHD or something, you might struggle to concentrate without some other stimulus.
I was just going to say, maybe my brain's wired differently, but I often find that I do concentrate better with some form of background, noise.
Yeah.
Whereas
if
I'm sort of sat in a room and it's absolute silence, I can't, it seems odd to say, but I can't seem to focus as well. Yeah. I actually sort of need that.
I used to think that way as well. And then I do both now, basically. I kind of have like two different modes almost I like to switch between. But I didn't think that I'd be able to do it. And I didn't think that it would really make a difference. I thought I was just sort of making myself more bored for the sake of it. But I don't think that that's reality. I do think it did help. But that's just me. Should we move on to some more of these? Next one I've got on my list is going broad instead of narrow, trying a range of techniques without mastering the fundamentals. This is something that, again, in my escapades as a young painter of trying to consume all the content in the world and download the information into my brain as if that was going to make me any good.
Yeah.
You hear all these like keywords when you're new, edge highlighting, wet blending, glazing. You feel like, okay, I need to know all of these. When in reality, especially if you have like a particular style that you like to paint, you're probably only going to be using of a range of say 20 techniques. You're probably going to use like five of them.
Yeah. Given it's picking out what's important amongst all the techniques.
And there are some that aren't going to cross over. For example, thinning your paints and knowing how to put down a nice smooth base coat is going to apply to literally every single style that you're going to paint. Mm. Whereas you might paint a model without ever glazing once. You could paint armies and armies without ever glazing.
Yeah, that's true.
I think that it is important to get a broad knowledge of how to execute painting before mastering stuff. I think that you've kind of got to go through that process to find what works for you, to find what you enjoy. And this is before we even talk about the situation. Like we said, if you're trying to get your models on the table really quick, you're not going to be glazing. You know, there's no point you learning glazing. Because being frank, like...
You're better off dry brushing.
It's difficult as well of like assumed knowledge because you almost don't know what you're meant to know and which techniques are critical, which I do completely understand.
Beginner to the hobby, he's like, well, what actually do I need to know to have a painted miniature at the end of a couple of hours of sitting there with my first set of stuff?
Sorry to segue, but this is where I think stuff like, for example, like contrasts so that paints do come in so handy, and it ties back right back to the other episode, your first episode or debut episode, if you want to call it anything. On here is that when we spoke about those, like I think that's one of the things that kind of mitigates that necessity to learn specific techniques and stuff, because ultimately those paints are designed for you to spray the model a color, put them on, and it does a lot of the work for you with shadows and highlights and etc. and all that kind of stuff. And
and not only that, you just get it out the pot and you put it on the model.
Yeah,
you haven't got to do any middle worry
too much. Unless you do put contrast medium and stuff into it or whatever, blah blah. But that's one of the real, I think, in virtues of that as a product, and also just to get you doing ultimately, which is a thing where it is the first step on the ladder, which is just getting paint on the model, you know. And once you start that process, you then start, because what will happen is, again, within that range of paints, there are some that are thicker than others, some that are dark, that give more contrast than others, some that maybe don't affect the model as much. I know if I use Apothecary White and if I used the black one, whatever it's called, the contrast, the black contrast paint called.
It's Black Templar, isn't it?
Black Templar, yeah. If you're using Apothecary White or Black Templar, they perform massively different in the way they work on the model, if that makes sense, you know, and they're both contrast paints from the same range. It's when you start using different paints within that range, as an example, that certain things start becoming, oh, maybe that's a little bit thick on that model. What can I do to make that a bit thinner? Well, there's this thing called contrast medium. If I put some of that into it, you know, and that's where you start going from the first step on the ladder to the next step on the ladder and so on and so forth. Yeah. That's kind of how your journey begins because you're like, you start almost naturally noticing these little things which make you then go down these different avenues of like, right, well, I need to work, find out how to do that because that's going to make that not be a problem.
It's like
anymore.
Finding the problems that you need to solve and then learning the technique for that kind of as you go, isn't
it? Yeah.
I think that goes back to like what I was saying about putting the hours in and putting the practice in, especially critically those first few models, even like when you haven't painted at all. Like you kind of need to just get your feet wet before you can actually start to figure out what are these problems that I need to solve and what are these techniques that I need to learn. You need to actually start like putting the paint down. So you know what problems it is you're looking to solve and then researching how to go about doing that.
It's just getting a feel for actually the painting process. Putting the paint on the model is just getting a feel for how the brush feels and how it actually feels to paint something rather than just, you know, sitting there listening to or, you know, having it, all these discussions about it. You've got to actually do it.
I think that ties really nicely back around to what you were saying before about like, you know, you can sit there and watch 5,000 videos on how to paint models, that's not going to give you the sensation or the control of the brush, or it's not going to start teaching you any of those things. Like what is going to teach you is getting paint out, putting it on the model, and actually learning from the experience of applying paint.
Watch the video, learn the technique, and then, like you said, was it putting into practice? What was
I can understand. Like there is some anxiety around it because obviously expectation doesn't always meet
reality.
And
there is that fear as well of like the models are expensive and you don't want to ruin them. You put a lot of time into it.
But this is why I was like, I'm not being funny. If you're going out and buying a brand new, I'm going to pull it an Avatar of Kane, Angron or your Mortari, like if you're buying a model like that and it's the first model you're painting, there's nothing inherently wrong with maybe you starting with that model, but I wouldn't set my Everest of expectation to be, well, that's the box art. I'm going to try and do that as my first, like that. I think without any kind of guidance or not even guidance, without any kind of self exposure to putting paint on a miniature, you're not going to, now you could, I mean, I'm saying this, but there could be someone out there that got Angron or Mortarian for the first time and literally got all the paints because it's on the back of the box or got all the paints that suggested in some tutorial and just went ham and managed to get it 80% close. I mean, that'd be incredible if that's the case, and hats off to you if you do that. But I think the vast majority of people that do have the apprehension, that do have the anxiety, that do think this model costs so much money or this costs X amount of pounds or whatever currency you obviously have, you know, I think that barrier makes it a lot less realistic you expecting to get it like that. And I think the thing that I would always advocate to anybody is like, if you just buy it, go on eBay, buy a couple of cheap models,
Or if you've bought an army, like just focus on the less important ones.
Yeah.
Because there's going to be some, you know, smaller, lesser models and not your centerpiece characters.
Yeah.
I think that scales though, what you're saying as well, because I don't think that's necessarily even a beginner focused thing. So like, for example, I am not great at painting non-metallic metal because I've barely done any of it. And I set the challenge for myself of when preparing a competition piece that I'm doing at the moment, a Night Relictor that I'm doing, Stormcast model.
Mm.
I said, okay, I'm going to use this as a excuse to try and practice some of that skill. But rather than, like James said, setting myself the Everest of I'm going to do this full NMM model and it's going to look like Rich Gray's and I'm going to win all these competitions as a ridiculous task, I've said, okay, I would like, there's a little bit of trim on the cloth that I would like to do in a non-metallic metal finish, and I'm going to paint that and I'm going to practice that. And then on the next model, maybe I'll scale that up or do a bigger piece of fabric. Or maybe I'll do, then after that will be another model where, okay, it's got some metallic armor, but it's not like fully armored. And then you start working your way up that ladder, like you said.
And I've got to say this just to tack onto that, like, because one thing I'm really conscious we do discuss and do talk about on here is just everyone's different approaches, or to use the show's name, the different perspectives on actually painting miniatures. Like, that might be one way to start, the way that George has explained, but another way might be to go ham and just grab a model and just grab the relevant colors for gold, silver, bronze, copper, whatever metallic you want to do in non-metallic metal, and practice the blending and the light placement, all of that on a big object. But I still wouldn't set your goal of I'm getting every single part of that model perfectly blended and perfectly lit. I'd go, well, I'm going to sketch all the colors on, get it roughly how I think it should look, but then I'm going to focus just on the shoulder pad and I'm going to try and get the shoulder pad as
I think that's a perfectly valid way to approach it. I have no apprehension for anyone wanting to just, you know, dive in deep and give it a go, but have the expectations that it's not going to be perfect on the first try.
Yeah, and not be too disheartened by that fact.
Yeah, exactly.
I mean, we always say this, like, but I'm, again, it's through experience and through years, obviously, painting, and I'm sure anyone who's watching this who's been painting for a long time will agree, like, if I could go back to myself at a young age and go, I know at the moment you look at your models and you hate them, but this is where you'll get to.
You'll get better.
Or you'll get to, or this is an example where you'll be at in 5 years. That, if someone could almost, again, Doc from Back to the Future could come back and go, if someone could come back and go, James, like, you know, this is kind of like where you're at now, but don't be disheartened by that, because if you keep practicing that thing that you're doing, you will get to this point and look at what you've done. Do you know what I mean? Like, that would be amazing for everybody if you could do that. That's obviously not reality, but I think the thing to flip that with is by going, right, well, repetition's a mother of success. If I do this 5 times, the fifth time will be better than the first time.
Yeah.
And having that confidence, again, to chuck the acronym that I always use, fear, false expectations appearing real, your false expectations of what something is going to be, you're not going to know what it's like until you've actually done it, you know, and then done it again and again and again. I've learned from those previous, that's going to conquer that fear that you're experiencing. And ultimately, when you apply that process or technique or that colorway onto another miniature or onto another part of your army or whatever it is you're doing, you'll have a much better starting point and trampoline to progress and do better on the next piece. And that's something that I think that all of us need to just take a step back sometimes and realize that in that moment, what we've painted and what we've done isn't going to be the best of our ability, because we will constantly be progressing as we push harder.
Yeah. You
know? And that's something that I'd always say.
Mm-hmm.
So
we frequently hear from you with questions asking how you can paint like our team of world-class and award-winning artists. Teaching is something that all of the team here at Siege are very passionate about. And we want to share with you the methods and techniques that we use to paint every single day, all of the incredible miniatures and armies that you have seen from us. With the Siege Studios Patreon, you'll gain access to a growing catalogue of over 300 step-by-step tutorials covering a huge variety of colour schemes, miniatures, painting styles and techniques, from beginner-focused foundation tutorials to full character masterclasses. Each lesson comes in a beautifully designed and easy-to-follow PDF format with accompanying artist commentary, with new tutorials added every single week. Your subscription also includes access to our private Patreon channels on Discord, so that you can interact directly with our artists asking for questions or feedback. You'll also be supporting the podcast directly, helping us to bring you these episodes every single week. So if you want to take your painting to the next level and make the most of your very valuable hobby time, head over to patreon.com/Siege Studios. Next one I've got on here, this actually kind of ties nicely in with what you're saying about your Harbinger, Paul, which is the idea of the different approaches to painting, of if you want to improve, not necessarily treating painting in the same way as I want to get the job done. So there's this massive obsession with speed in the hobby, understandably, and that has naturally led to styles that incorporate a lot of shortcuts to get things done faster. But I'm proposing this idea that, is that necessarily going to improve your skill overall in the broader sense? So you were talking about how before, when you was painting, you was doing it a bit faster and, you know, using the contrast paints and things like that. But now you're looking at painting to a higher level. You're kind of having to treat the mindset completely differently in your approach to getting those and to dial those techniques in. You're kind of not starting from square one, because you've obviously got the brush control and the repetition from practicing. And I'm not discrediting that you can't learn how to paint by doing that. But when you start looking at wanting to take the next steps, there's kind of this new approach to painting that I think you've got to take.
Yeah, I think it kind of depends. If you're an army painter, then there's a kind of a difference. I don't collect an army. So I've got the luxury of just picking any model that I like the look of and spending as long as I want painting it. If you're painting an army, you know, you want to, I assume that most people that collect an army want to actually game with that army at some point to, you know, and have it painted. So I suppose there's kind of two different painting techniques maybe that you use for your characters and all your fodder kind of troops, you know? So where speed painting might come in handy for all your rank and file, you have got, but then you've got to learn two different techniques, perhaps one for your fodder and one for your characters.
Yeah. And there's definitely a skill in that, like, you know, getting things to look really, really good in lesser amount of time. There's definitely a skill there element is, yeah. in there within
But
that.
I think that, again, that will come the more you do it. The more yeah. you practice these things, the more they become, I don't want to say second nature.
Muscle memory.
But you'll become more proficient at yeah. them. And you'll just, I think naturally, you'll just become quicker anyway.
Well, I always think the goal should be, in my personal opinion, to be fast at neat, sharp, smooth, refined. If you can, they seem like two opposite, it seems like an oxymoron, like they're different ends mm. of the scale, but they're really not. Because like if you get good at blocking in colours efficiently and smoothly and you learn dilution, learn your paint and learn all those things, like it, all of that harmonises and allows you to actually paint models more efficiently. That's before, like, because painting process is one thing, painting quality is another thing, and time investment is another thing. They're three things, and there's multiple other things that are involved within painting miniatures. Yeah. But for me, whenever I talk to anybody about, I want to be better as a painter, but I also want to be quicker, like, that sounds like it's an impossibility, but it really isn't. It's a case of just working your process, knowing your process, knowing the approach to painting the models, making informed choices from experience of paint and et cetera, and all those other things. And at the same time, the thing that you do need to do is put the hours in, get at the speed that you're at, because what happens is that you will get quicker through doing it more and more and more and more. So it will get to a point whereby if someone says to you, we'll block in that pouch, you'll be way quicker than the first time yeah. you've ever done it. You know, and yeah. I think that training yourself and learning to be fast whilst retaining the speed, whilst retaining the quality, is that the best happy medium that you can go for, because then you're constantly working both sides of the fence, yeah. you know.
I think where I was coming at when writing this point was the mindset of speed painting is cutting out all the little things that you don't need to be doing. And I've said on previous episodes mm. about how it's those little details that do make the difference. Mm-hmm. So if you approach your painting with, okay, I'm going to shortcut this because that doesn't really matter and that's going to waste time and you're not going to yeah. notice it anyway. But all those little things do add up. And I think if you're looking at other people's models and you're saying, oh, why don't mine look like that? But then you're sitting down to paint and you're treating it like you're batch painting a yeah. big army, and I don't want to, you know, paint all the ribbing in between the armor, and I don't want to give it 4 hours because it's going to take a load of time. I completely understand that, but having this like weird expectation of, I want it to look like this, and then I sit down to paint
and
I'm rushing through it.
Yeah.
And I really struggled when I was learning to paint of, I was hearing all these higher end painters talking about how long it took them to paint a model.
Mm.
And I remember sitting down one weekend and being like, I'm just going to take as long as it takes. I'm going to sit here and I'm going to really, really methodically paint this model. I'm going to paint really slowly. Mm. And then I painted a Space Marine in like 2 hours, which to me now, with someone who might spend like 20 hours painting a Marine, is lunacy.
Mm.
But I was shortcutting stuff still. I was focused on painting neatly and sharply, like James said, and the model looked nice, but there wasn't that attention to detail. I didn't paint all the little buttons. I didn't add a highlight and a shade and to every single little individual detail. So I have this expectation of like, oh, I really want it to look like this. Yeah. And I sit down to paint and I go, well, I'm painting neat and I'm taking my time. So why does it look like that? Mm. But then you're still shortcutting.
It's perfectly good for a game.
Exactly.
It's perfectly good for...
I think it's a perfectly valid way to paint in general. Like, I'm not discrediting that at all. And there's certainly, it's certainly absolutely fine to do that. And you can have some amazing looking armies by doing that. But sitting, for me, in my experience, when I was sitting down trying to go, okay, I really want to push my skill,
yeah.
but then wasn't really following through on that the whole way.
I think that's why when I sort of got back into it, and I used the speed paints as a sort of stepping stone to get back into things, you know, yeah, getting yeah. your muscle memory back, or what you want to call it. I very quickly decided that I wanted to sort of move on from just using the speed paints. So, I mean, obviously I'd paint them in the speed paints and it'd be great. But then I thought, well, actually, now I want to add the gold trim. I basically use the speed paints more as a base cut, as a basing sort of medium for adding things on top of,
mm-hmm.
so that I could, especially for like a Death Guard and things like that I was painting, I could put my main color on, forget about it, and then I could spend the time on all the little bits and pieces. I think mostly because I wasn't any good at ever edge highlighting and doing that sort of highlighting. So the speed paints kind of did that for you. Yeah. So then that means I could spend the time on things that I did enjoy doing, like the pouches, the weapons, the trim, and, you know, the bones and the intestines that are hanging out of all the Marines and things like that. So, but then obviously, see, it's a slippery slope, because once you start learning to do a new little technique, you think, I might learn to do something else as well. And then the time adds on. So then you're not kind of painting quickly anymore. No. Your painting is taking a lot longer because I don't do batch painting. I've never enjoyed batch painting. I did paint 7 Plague Marines when I got back into it, and I found the process torturous. I didn't enjoy it. They didn't look as well as I wanted them to at the end of it, because by the time I was doing 7 shoulder pads, I just lost interest in doing it. So I always paint one at a time, no matter what it is. So even like your rank and file, I always ended up spending way too long on those miniatures. And then the character models that you did didn't seem to stand out.
It's almost like what Peachy was saying. He was like, it's more about the spectacle of the whole army rather than the individual.
Yeah.
And it's almost like the character is the spectacle, and that's why it does get the attention.
That's it.
The time it does. But then
I find it difficult to do that.
I pick up
a rank and file, and I think, it just doesn't look that good to me. But from 4 feet away on the table, it looks absolutely fine.
Yeah.
I suppose a way you could do that as well is like, if you do have a ceiling of capability of painting, doing that on the characters and then intentionally stripping away some of the things that you are capable of doing on those other miniatures so that the character stands out even more.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, yeah, good idea.
Okay.
But sometimes my brain just won't allow that.
Okay, my next point on this list is something which is quite near and dear to me, which is learning to critique your own models and learning from other people, but in a visual sense, and, you know, going, theirs is better than mine, but not analysing why.
Why
it something is, that I really, really doubled down on early on, and I do really think it was really, really pivotal and important for my painting, was just spending time getting up like competition photos or people's Instagram pages on my computer on a big screen and just sitting there and actually looking at someone's work for more than 10 seconds when you're doom scrolling on Instagram.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Because it's so easy to look at something at face value and be like, oh, that looks amazing. And then you start like picking into it and you go like, oh, well, actually, I would have probably done that a bit better.
Yeah.
And you start like picking things apart. And as well as that, on the other end, looking at stuff that is amazing and trying to work out why, like sitting there and zooming in a model and going, oh, well, actually they use like these colors to highlight that. I probably wouldn't have thought of that.
Yeah.
I probably used to, you know, I probably would have added white into my mix, but they've added, it looks like a little bit of yellow. It's quite a warm style. Like, and once you learn how to do that by looking at other people's stuff, you can start to do it with your own models and you can start to work out what your weak points are so that you can improve those and focus on the things that, you know, you're not good at that are going to see those improvements.
I think everyone's definitely their own worst critic.
Yeah.
And I think we already touched on it where you say like, well, if I bring my modeling to show you, I immediately make excuses for why certain things that I'm unhappy with, to, you know, pointing out to you that I'm unhappy with it so that you don't point that out to me.
Yeah. Yeah.
So,
but going deeper than that, like it's so useless to just sit in your model and go, I don't like it. It's not good enough.
Yeah.
Why?
Like, yeah.
Okay. Yeah. I don't like this color choice that I used. Okay, well, let's go further into that. Yeah. Like, why did you pick those colors? What was the thought process behind that?
What would work better?
Okay, you did use those colors. What could you have done to sharpen up your highlights that would have made that look neater? So, and maybe it actually wasn't the colors that you used.
Yeah.
It was actually the execution of that. Maybe the color was nice, but the wash you put over it wasn't appropriate for that color. Like, actually, maybe even like just sitting with a notepad and looking at your model, making an actual list of things.
Yeah.
And then in an ideal world, doing another one, implementing all of those points that you pointed out on the previous one. I mean, that's something we've spoken about before, isn't it? About getting a box of models and working through them one by one and analyzing them. But I think a really good way to approach that is by looking at work that you do love and not only working out why you love it, but maybe even find some things that you don't like about it, or maybe aren't to your personal taste. So that if I was painting that model, what would I have done?
Yeah. Or just sort of saying to yourself, well, okay, what 3 things do I love about it, and what 3 things should I work on for my next one?
Yeah,
maybe make a little list. But I'm doing like making lists and things. I'm doing that more now anyway. I find, especially when you're going back a little bit to speed painting and things, actually writing down what I'm doing in the first place, and then using that as a reference for the next one. Which obviously,
especially if you're painting one model out of a squad at a time, you want that to look the same.
Yeah.
If you've got inconsistencies of choice in that process.
But I like, for critiquing other people's work and things, it's like every time Adam shows me anything in the room next door, I mean, his stuff's always next level anyway. But I mean, I always have so many questions for him. And I would say, well, how'd you do that? Because I look at it and think, I can't tell how you did that.
It's so difficult.
How did you do that?
It's difficult because you got to.
He's so good. He's so patient with me.
When you're looking at other people's stuff, when you're looking at stuff like you're saying on a big screen or whatever, I always say this, but painting miniatures and painting in general, like when you look at art in a gallery or like that, it's almost like another language. You're learning that language of the way the person has applied the paint or has made the decisions that they've done. Like, and the thing that makes it really difficult is it's not like actual languages like learning Spanish or learning a different language.
Yeah.
Because you might have regional dialects of that language, but when you translate that to miniature painting, every single painter has a different way or approach. So it's almost like that regional dialect
in
miniature painting is magnified exponentially. So understanding that from day one, I think, is really important, because you might look at two miniatures painted very similarly in execution, but the way and the choices and the things that the individual painters have chosen to get to that result can be leagues apart.
Yeah.
And I think that's really important to take note, and obviously to be conscious of, because they might be given, we always say this, but you might give two painters very similar sets of paints, as in like here's 30 paints that are the same as this person's 30 paints. You've both got to paint an ultramarine, or you've both got to paint X faction, insert here, model, whatever, blah, blah. Both of their approaches will be massively different. And I think that understanding that is really, really important.
But even if you don't have the language to necessarily like articulate that, especially if you're early on in your journey, if you look at their model and you can't, you might not necessarily have the words or the visual understanding to know what it is specifically, but at least acknowledging that and pointing out and making a note of it starts to put you on the path to understanding that.
Yes, definitely.
I think as well, especially early on when you're getting, you know, you haven't been painting long and things, I think you should also not just critique your model in a negative way.
I'm so glad you are,
because
you said that.
Especially early on when your expectation is this, and you know, you're left with something that doesn't quite meet that expectation, and you look and you think, I hate it. It looks terrible. Part of that process is fine, because you need that to prepare to get better. But you should also sort of look at it and think, well, actually, there are quite a few negatives here, but the positives that I can get from those negatives in moving forward, that's got to be something worth sort of keeping for yourself as well.
Yeah, it is. And I think understanding the mistakes you've made, understanding the errors you've made, you know, and I don't want to use the word failure, because I hate that word for the strength of impact that it has. But those issues that you find on miniatures that you've painted, they are those mistakes, those failures that you've achieved or whatever, blah, blah. That's what teaches you to paint better moving forward. But I'm so glad you brought up about feedback, because it's a part of this whole industry and what I have to do for a lot of the things I do at Siege now, like that I deal with on a day-to-day basis, talking to painters, talking to, looking at portfolios, looking at all those kind of things. Like, feedback is something that over the years, from my personal experience, it's always been given in a way that's very direct and linear. And what I mean by that is it's like you just get told these things from the perspective of that person viewing it, but they're never separated at the point of delivery into factual or opinionated.
Yeah.
Which is how I've always tried to give feedback to anybody that's ever asked it from me. And I'm a painter of a very mid area in the grand scheme of things compared to a lot of the painters that are in the industry. But what I would definitely say is that separating it into those two specific columns, it adds so much wealth to the person receiving it. Just giving a very linear approach to feedback, it's almost like vomiting just information at the person, and like they're like, oh, what the hell do I do? Like, you know, and I understand that totally, which is why whenever I do give it and whenever I do talk to people, I always say, right, so I'm going to talk to you about the factual stuff first of all. There's a mold line there. I can see a join in the model there. I can see you haven't drilled the barrel with a drill. I can see that you've tried to do some blending there on that sword where the blending is. There's a watermark here that's quite stark, or you know, you've not blended between the mid to the light very well because there's quite a few like tide marks in there or join lines, or you've not glazed that enough. Like that, all of that, when you deliver it in a way and you say it's factual, because it's on the model, it's there, you've done it, you can't argue with it. It's not like I'm going, there's a mold line there. No, there's not. Well, there's a mold line there. Yeah. No, you can't argue with that. That gives you some clear things to go, right, well, on the next one I do, I'm not going to do any of those things. Yeah. Mm. When it comes to the opinionated column, which is what I'll always do secondary, because I think the factual stuff is always important that you deliver that first to somebody. The opinionated is, okay, it's a red model. You've painted a
blood angel.
Oh, I didn't say it, but it is.
A red right, model. That's okay. What you're getting at.
It could
right?
be a dragon.
It could be the Genesis chapter.
It could be
the
Genesis.
It could, yeah, it could
all right,
be.
All right, well, it could be. Okay, yeah, let's could. Just change it then. Yeah. You've painted a green model. There you go. Right, okay. So you've painted... I can't win. Right, okay.
I've painted an ultramarine.
No. Screw you all. You've painted a yellow model. There you go. All right, okay.
Imperial fists.
There we go. Right, so you painted a yellow...
It's the helmet on his assault squad of blood angels.
I literally cannot win. So you painted a yellow model or object of a model. And like you've chosen X color for the lenses or for the gems or for whatever. Okay. There's nothing wrong with that color. You can choose because of art, because of, you know, all that you can make whatever choices you want on the model, blah, blah. But I personally would have done it in this color. All right.
Because
okay?
It's not law accurate.
No, it's, not even down to, it's not even down
it's
to
not law accurate.
It's not even down to
that
law.
Blood angel.
It's not even down to law.
I get what you're saying,
accuracies.
Though. Like you've got the things that are more opinionated. So yeah. I didn't like that color choice personally. I think it would have had more contrast if you chosen this other color.
Yeah.
However, that's my opinion on it. Someone might disagree.
Yeah.
Someone
yeah,
might
exactly.
really
but
like
technically,
it.
It's very good.
Yeah. But what you've done with the color you've applied on there is really good. Like you could have a perfectly blended sword or cape or, you know, a flesh that's done really well, or whatever. It's smooth. Mm. It's, you know, it's got nice tonal variants on it, but maybe the hue isn't quite correct for the sword or for the cape or like that's more, but I think that when you separate it into those two specific columns of information that you're giving to somebody, I think that the process of analyzing that upon as a receiver, it just gives you a much better starting point for the next time you approach a model, either that's the same or you're going to apply something. You go, okay, what factually is wrong with that model that I can't argue with? Okay, it's all these things. I'll sort those out. So that column is ticked. Then you look at the opinion and go, right, well, they liked purple for that, but I've chosen this color, whatever, blah, blah, blah. That's just your choice whether, and it's at that point where you go, okay, well, that person's opinion, do I want to agree with that? Or do I want to try it and see if I agree with that thing? Or, you know,
this does tie into what I said as well, because I think even when you're analyzing your own stuff, you can still put it into those two categories. Because if you're analyzing your own work and you're trying to work out, okay, what is it that I need to improve? Obviously you're going to have a bias of your own opinions and it's the model that you painted, understandably, but trying to separate that, like you said, okay, there's a mold line there, I can put that in my own category of that's a factual thing versus that's a I didn't like this color choice that I used, or I thought that this highlight wasn't sharp enough. Is that an objective thing or is that a factual thing?
Big news, tickets are now on sale for the Siege Studios painting classes for 2024. For over 8 years, we've been running in-depth, hands-on classes across the UK, which has allowed us to create the perfect learning environment for improving your painting skills. With a variety of topics available, all our courses are taught by senior artists and feature practical demonstrations in a relaxed environment that welcomes interaction from you, discussions on theory, and an open Q&A session so you can ask that burning question you've had on your mind. You can even bring your models for feedback. To book now and reserve your place before tickets sell out, head over to siegestudios.co.uk/shop. I'll see you on a class soon. I know someone that got feedback after a model that he put like 40, 50 hours into. And the feedback was, I just don't like the model.
Yeah.
And I'm like, how is that going to help the person to progress as a painter?
And you can also massively discredit that, because it's like, okay, well, he didn't like that model. I could have asked for the same feedback from a different person, got a completely different answer because they did like the model.
Do you know what I mean? And it's just like, that does not help that person at all whatsoever. That you got to, from a person, when you get asked for feedback, and this is the other thing, I want to flip it on the other side of the table as well. Like when someone asks you for feedback, they're either asking you because A, they're a friend and they just want some friendly advice from someone that they ultimately respect their opinion of, you know, or B, you're someone that they feel is a better painter than them. So they're coming to you for assistance and help. So what you tell them is gonna either aid or mitigate and make the process harder for them when they're painting, on their journey of painting. It's a hugely humbling thing to have someone come to you and go, "I really want you to give me some feedback on the model."
Yeah.
Right. So So if you're receiving those kind of questions, or if you're getting someone asking you about getting feedback, then I think honestly the best thing to do is just think like, how would I want to be given feedback? And that's the way that you should give feedback.
Yeah. Like, if you've been asked, you need to be responsible with your response in how you deliver that.
Yeah, because you ultimately have a sorry to keep using the word responsibility, but you have a responsibility to give that person the best assistance for their painting.
And not totally crush all their hopes and dreams.
Yeah. And that's an easy thing to do, but it's not a useful thing to do because it's not actually helpful. If you've been shown a model by someone, maybe it's one of the first models they're painting, they're asking for feedback, and you just sit there and rip it to pieces and tell them all the reasons why it's bad.
Yeah.
That doesn't help them.
I think something to always say is always caveat and say, look, I'm going to split it into those two categories. The factual stuff you might not like. Yeah. All right, okay, but I'm going to tell you because I'm trying to help you, you know. And the other thing I would say is if you're asking for feedback, like, don't just hunt for the good. You know, like if you're asking for feedback because you want someone to inflate you a little bit.
People sometimes people are asking for it and they're just hunting for some gratification. They want to inflate their own ego.
That's not, unfortunately, like, just because you painted some of the edge highlights super sharp and straight and you want someone to say, cool, your edges look super sharp and straight or whatever, blah, blah. How much value is that going to give you as a painter when they're focusing on that? And really the thing that's going to be giving you benefit and aid is someone going, yeah, your edges are sharp and straight, but you've bled a little bit with all your shading, you know, how your edge highlight might be great, but your pin shading or soft shading or deep shading might not be as well executed. It's like, you know, like for me, it's just like, you've got to give feedback in a way that it actually aids that person. And also as a receiver, understand that if you're asking for it, like I know people that are extremely direct and almost not brutal, but they're extremely direct with feedback because that's what they would want because they want to be, I think if someone's telling you the positive all the time, that's not going to improve you as a painter.
Well, I'm sure you've been on the receiving end of that. It's like I've sometimes asked people for some feedback or some advice. And I can tell that they're trying to be polite.
Yeah.
So I know that they're not being genuine with the feedback that they're trying to give me.
Yeah.
It's very, very nice to have people tell you that they love the model and whatever. But if you're actually humbly going to someone and asking for critique, I guess that's the difference, isn't it? If you're looking for like actual critique rather than
inflation.
It depends on what you're asking for, I think. Are you asking for someone's... I think for myself, it doesn't matter how brutal the technical feedback is, I'm fine with that. Because, like you said, it's, you know, you can see it on the model. It's factually there, and I need to do something in my process to change that, to adapt. Whereas, or are you actually asking for someone's opinion?
Yeah.
And I always think I'd rather have someone's brutal, honest, technical advice rather than someone's brutal, honest opinion on my model. Because I always find if you don't like it, that's your opinion.
But that makes me sad. But that gives you nothing. That gives you nothing to progress.
It makes me feel a bit. Obviously, I'm happy that you don't like it, but like it doesn't. Like you say, it doesn't help me with what's wrong with it. I'd rather know what is wrong with it so that I can adapt as a painter. Like,
which is
I always
why
try and distance myself from other people's opinions of my things because. Ultimately, my opinions matter most on my work. So I do love it and I do value everybody's opinions on it, but I value people's technical skill-based opinions rather than their personal thing, taste on colours that I've used rather than that sort of, if that makes sense.
Yeah, it does. Yeah.
Because obviously as a sort of very beginner painter, I want to improve, you know, and I'm looking for those tips and advice and especially from you guys' point of view, you can see immediately where I've gone wrong on things because you've got that level of experience. Whereas I haven't, I've done this and think, yeah, that's all right. But you can instantly spot things that I would never see.
Yeah, but Paul, I also have that. I ask people to critique my stuff and I'm in some circles of people that are way more advanced painters than me that have either factually won more stuff than me or that have, you know, have been painting longer than me or whatever the case may be. And I have the exact same experience.
Yeah.
And I've been painting since I was six, but not Warhammer, obviously. 3 years of it was AFX and stuff. And then from 9, it was obviously Warhammer and stuff. But I've been painting a couple of decades.
Yeah.
And I still have that now.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, like I still, you know, I've had it before where I'll name names. I've had the Wizard Rich Gray look at some of my yeah. models and I've been sat there with him and he's been to give me feedback and I've said to him, look, I'm not, you can't offend me. You can tear me a new one.
Yeah, yeah.
Like, it doesn't bother me. Like, because I just want to know where my weaknesses are yeah. and where I'm not, where I'm not doing as good as I should, yeah. should be doing, my, you know. And it is grueling. You yeah. are going to feel like a bit silly, maybe if you've missed something or if you've left a gap there or yeah. things like that. But you will learn from that, you know. And I think that's really something really important. Just to briefly segue into something, I think when it's actually quite one thing to also be conscious of when it comes to feedback is actually asking someone that. And this is where it gets a little bit grey, which I'm going to explain about. But actually asking somebody that for you, when you look at the stuff that they paint,
yeah.
is a benchmark of where you want to go as a painter and they have tangible skill that you feel is better than yours.
Yeah.
Okay. And this is within the realms of art because obviously one painter might look at something and go, that's great. And the other person might look at it and go, it's not whatever, blah, blah. But as long as you are engaged with their painting and it looks, in your opinion, better, more technically well executed, or you prefer the color choices or you prefer the way that it's actually formulated and done, those are the things to determine whether that is the person you should be getting feedback or not.
Yeah.
It like there could be another painter that maybe you don't like their work or you don't like the way they paint models that maybe on a technical level is better than this person that you do, but that doesn't mean you shouldn't not ask this person.
Yeah, yeah.
That makes sense. It has to be linear for you to look at that person's work and go, I think they're better than me based on this, which is my opinion. I want the feedback from that person. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
Yeah, that's how I would always select somebody.
Yeah.
To give me feedback, you know. Yeah.
Just on your point, the Rich Gray thing as well, I think it's important to maybe acknowledge the sense of responsibility in the sense of you said to him, please be brutal with your feedback.
I always say that, yeah.
But maybe just acknowledging the context of that the person has asked you for that feedback and trying to tailor your response because you don't want to just tear someone down.
Yeah.
Maybe wasn't expecting it and just blindsiding them because that's going to discourage.
No, of course. Yeah, yeah. Yeah. No, you are right. Yeah. I mean, I think anyone who I've asked feedback for in the past knows that like, I don't really care what they say, like in the, not in the sense of the information, what they're saying.
Not being offended by it.
Like, cause the thing is I wouldn't be asking them, like it's going back to the thing I said, I wouldn't be asking if I didn't think A, factually they're a better painter than me. B, that I value their experience over mine totally. Yeah. Like anything that they can help to steer my journey as best as possible for me is really complimenting them, if that makes sense, you know? So like, that doesn't bother me. And the thing is like, I do think part of it, I've got to be honest, I do think part of it is a mindset thing as well. Like for me, because of how I've always been in like super competitive with like wanting to do the best I can and in that kind of way, like ultimately when someone tells me something's crap or it's not smooth or it's not done better, I won't say it in the way I normally say it, but like my mindset is I'm going to prove you wrong.
Yeah.
Like, and like, I think having that combined hunger for betterment for yourself, as well as valuing the brutality of honesty. I think if you can combine those two things and synergize them together in the way that your mindset is and the approach to painting, I think you'll have massive gains when it comes to your execution and models. Yeah. I think it helps hugely.
Okay. Well, speaking of mindset, that comes to my final point on this list, which is that thing of like a clean and tidy workspace, clean and tidy mind, clean and tidy results.
Mm.
I like the idea of being polite to your equipment and having a nice organized working environment. I'm getting a lot of looks as I say this.
I'm half on half.
It depends. For me, it depends how much space you have in your house to do your chosen hobby. So I've got like, if you can imagine an A4 sheet of paper, I think my workspace is like A2, which is four times the size or something like that of an A4 sheet.
A small desk.
So I've got a very small little area that I try and cram everything onto it. So when my painting area is probably is the untidiest small space you could possibly imagine.
But that interests me because I also have a very, very tiny hobby space, which is why to me it's even more important that I keep it clean and tidy so that I can keep my thoughts organized.
Between painting sessions, because I put it away because obviously, you know, I've got a daughter, a six-year-old daughter, nearly seven now, but, you know, all those paints and, like, you know, I don't have glues and, you know, my scalpel, you know, all my hobby tools all lying around, they're all put away at the end of it, but during the process, it's like a grenade's gone off on my desk.
Let me unpack and go into this a bit further before we divulge too much. But if you're going a bit further into this, I do believe that being very methodical and like for cleaning all of your equipment so that it performs as high as possible. And this was a little thing that I didn't realize for way too long, which was like having a clean water cup so that you haven't got like metallic flakes like floating around in there and paint debris and whatever that when you're painting the model is coming off and it's fighting you. Doing those small things to your workspace, in my opinion and in my experience, has led to cleaner results in my painting.
I actually have 3 pots of water when I'm painting.
Oh, you're one of those people.
Well,
I
don't know what that's meant to mean. But
I use 3.
I've always used 3. I just have 1 for general getting the paint off my brush, 1 for metallic paint, and then I have another jar, which I generally use for diluting my paint down because I don't use my dirty water.
Which one do you drink out of?
every single pot of water obviously ends up in my mouth because I always put my paintbrush in my mouth.
Yeah.
So, you know, always have a bit of a taste of all of them. But I think the dirty paint one's my favourite, I guess. And I also have a cup of tea or a cup of coffee always next. And it's always, I'm doing this kind of Russian roulette thing. You know, don't look. not this time.
Put your metallic in your tea.
Yeah.
I use 3 cups of water, 1 for metallic, 1 for acrylic. And I just have one as like almost like a cleaning.
A final clean.
And I'll only really use that for when I'm using acrylics. So I'll clean massively in the first one.
Right, yeah.
And then I'll go into the second one to give it a clean. And all my metallic stays in metallic. And
yeah,
I never do like a secondary clean from metallic in the thing. Because I just, if I'm working on metallics, I'll be doing all the metallics. So a little bit of extra metallic flake in with a metallic won't necessarily make too much of a difference, if that makes sense.
I know what you mean. Just to steer this back a little bit into the idea of the self-taught mini painter thing, I think part of the reason that I put this on the list was I think you develop a lot of bad habits because you don't necessarily know that what you're doing is negatively impacting you. For example, like I said about I used to be really, really lazy about cleaning my water pot because I didn't realize that having a clean water pot would mean that there was less paint debris floating around, which means that there was less crap getting on my brush, which meant it wasn't going on the model and so on. Or being really, really abusive to my brushes. I mean, we've done a whole episode on brush care. You don't realize these bad habits that you're forming. So trying to, I guess, critically think about what it is you're doing with your setup and how it's impacting your painting.
Definitely brush care for me was a thing. In the past when I painted, finished painting, a little bit of water, straight in the mouth, stick it in the jar, job done. But now I'm starting to pay a bit more attention into what I'm doing, obviously, but actually buying some better equipment, some better brushes. I want to take care of them, obviously, because I want those fine lines. I want to be able to paint and things.
And so, if you look after those things, they'll look after you.
It's that age old thing, isn't it? You know,
well, it's true though. That is the case. That's very much the case.
The amount of times I see people with I quite enjoy airbrushing, and the amount of times I see people that like have their airbrush and they're just like, oh, I'm done with it now. I'll just sort of put it down on the desk and it's like drying up and they've got all paint in there. And then the airbrush gets this stigma of being like quite a difficult, cumbersome tool to work with because it's always clogging up. But really it's a user issue because, for example, when I finish with my airbrush, I'll spray loads of water through it just to flush everything out. Then I'll disassemble the airbrush, I'll clean the needle, I'll clean the nozzle out, reassemble airbrush cleaners going through it so that it re-lubricates all of the seals. And next time it's ready to use and I haven't got this barrier of like, okay, want to airbrush. Oh, I didn't clean it out last time. I've got to spend 25 minutes, you know?
Yeah. I want to steer it back onto the thing about desks. Because for me, that's something that me and Adam are very similar about next door. So we actually have a very, very similar approach to our hobby setup. So I've got a decent size working area, which I'm privileged to have, which is great. But I am a bit like, I see the end when I finish a project. The cleaning of the desk for me is like the return to normality, if that makes sense. I like when I'm working, I like having loads of things around me, like loads of things that I can just, if I'm mid-flow, I'm like, oh, I'm doing a cape. Maybe I should glaze some purple into that green cloth just to give it like a bit of a harmonious sort of shadow colour or something like that, blah, blah. Like I like having loads of things and options around me. So I find it helps with that creative flow or process, but that's just me personally. And my desk starts really neat, tidy, perfect, etc. And then more just chaos. Descends into visual chaos.
Yeah.
And then I finish the model. I'm like, yeah, I'm glad the model's done, etc. Blah, blah. before I start another project or start another model, or even you know, even a session at sometimes, I'm literally like, I've got to get, I can't handle it being left like this, and then I've got a full clean up. You know, etc. So my desk goes from being super neat and organized to absolute carnage, and then it returns back to tranquility before a new project starts or a new day starts or something like that. That's how it's always been for me, and that doesn't work for a lot of people. Like George, for example, he'll tell you right now, like, everything has to be like clinical, like a surgery, like everything neat, and which is fine, it's perfect. That is, and it, I think talking about sort of tying into the thing we said about earlier, it depends on the person sitting at the desk. Like,
I do agree with that. Like, just a caveat. Like, what I'm more talking about in the sense of, like, if you're a self-taught person, building those bad habits with your setup that are fighting you, if you get what I mean.
I would say that one person's bad habits are not the same as somebody else's bad habits.
No, that's fair. I mean, in the sense of, like, the objective things, like you're speaking about earlier. So, like, good brush care, like good etiquette with your setup, closing the lids on your paints properly, that sort of thing.
No, I agree totally. Like, I just think that, like, for me, I don't get visually distracted. Like, I don't have any, like, situational distraction or situational, like, distraction from those things being around me, which, so it doesn't affect my sort of like focus on the miniature. For some people like that do like to obviously have like a cleaner working area or whatever, blah blah, like that I can understand totally why, like, loads of paints with colors and all this stuff around you. If you're focusing on the model and you've got like a bright green over here and a bright red over, I understand totally how that could be distracting of attention, like, don't get me wrong. It does just boil down to the end user at the end of the day and what they find a better working environment for them is.
I agree with that. I'm not necessarily suggesting that if you're tidy, you're going to have better models, because that's not true. But I do believe in the mindset of, like, looking after everything, trying to be as, like, caters your workflow. So if you are someone who likes to have stuff everywhere, that's fair enough, but make sure everything's, like, looked after and you're responsible with the stuff that you own so that you can get the best possible results.
I mean, it's like you say, going back to brush care, it's no good expecting nice crisp lines if you're the hairs on your brush are all north and south, is it?
Yeah, exactly.
You know, it's just not going to work. So you've got to take that. There's a certain discipline involved with that sort of thing, isn't there? It's got to become part of your painting process. When you sit down to paint, you know, knowing that you've got the tools there and they're in good condition, because the last time you painted and did stuff, you took a few minutes just to clean them properly and make sure that, you know, the water's out of the ferrule and all the rest of it. So it is important. I am actually going I think because my desk is so small and everything is so cluttered, I do sometimes think, I'll do it another time. But
we've all had those days though,
of course, like, you do. I'm actually, and also now because I'm sort of progressing in my painting, I'm actually accumulating more things. So the process
there
of
is a difficulty in that
there is. Whereas, you know, I started off with one or two brushes, I've now got a jar with like 20 brushes in.
I'm not going to comment.
So I know, but from my sort of low leveling things, you know, and I've got Tupperware old sandwich boxes full of my paints, you know, that are just stacked in the corner and things.
I'm not going to comment.
Of course, the ones I want to use are all over the desk. So I think I think for my own sort of inner tranquility, it'd be quite nice to have a proper desk, a proper area with some proper paint.
It is nice. It does give you that, again, it's that setup and pack down time. That, you know, having that stuff just there, instantly accessible.
Having said that though, I've had both extremes. I've had very, very tiny little desk that was folded up in a hallway. I've had
I used to paint on the windowsill. That used to be my hobby area when I was as a young lad growing up. That used to be that's where my mother only allowed me to paint, in my bedroom, on the windowsill, which was sort of up here. Crying, painting some random solid rubber figure that I found at the local cheap shop, you know, just to practice some painting on when I was a kid. So that's, you know, we've all been there. We've all had those.
To my point though, like I've also had on the other end, like I used to rent an office space out just when I was painting full time, and I had the luxury of having loads and loads of room, and I had multiple desks and airbrushed up, and it was all great. At the minute, I'm at a very, very humble, I guess more average setup where I've got a dedicated desk for it, but you know, it lives in the corner.
The general hobbyist.
Yeah. But that being said, I've never felt that while it made my life easier and it was much more efficient when I was, you know, doing it for work, having all of that space, I've never really felt that it made a difference to my actual quality of my work. I think that this falsehood that if you're going to have this massive hobby desk with your big hobby zone drawers and all these shelves, well, that's going to make you better. You're just going to accumulate more stuff, yep, and you might have it, you might have a lower barrier to setup time, and there are a lot of creature comforts and quality of life upgrades that come with that. Completely understand. But I feel like I'm at my best painting level that I've ever been at in my life. Yeah. And I've got one of the smallest setups I've had in the different houses.
For me personally, I find it quite annoying. I get quite annoyed if knowing that I need something and it's not to hand, and I know that it's in a box over there somewhere.
But I still have that now. And
I have to get up and get out.
I have that now. And
you're
I've
an extreme. I promise.
I'm a fringe case here. But yeah.
Like I promise myself, if I got a bigger desk and had some proper racks, it'd all be, I wouldn't buy anything. Yeah, I don't need to buy anything extra. I'm telling
you, and then that becomes your new benchmark. And then you fill all that stuff out. I'm telling you,
from being at that point and more, like it doesn't get that way. So don't think that the desk with the storage and all that stuff means you don't buy more.
I would never do that. I would never do that, you know.
You say that, but trust me, you will. Like, you will 100%. And I'm sure anyone watching this or listening to this has been in the exact same situation. If I just get that one more rack, it means I can organise those paints that are in that box there. And then that box is empty. Oh, then there's this new paint range that's just come out. Oh, I'm just going to try five of those paints. Oh, why not?
I'll just get something else in that box. You know, like, sort of back to square one.
Yeah, trust me, it doesn't get any better. Like, I think, I don't know what the solution or answer is to that, because I'm at one end of the spectrum and I still have that problem now.
Yeah.
And I've got good storage. I've got drawers.
That sort of thing can bring me out of my, you know, headspace when I'm painting. You know, if I've got to nip off somewhere and go through the cupboard and find something that I should have got before I started painting, I didn't realize I would probably need, that can sort of take me out of the zone, as it were, sometimes.
Question of the week time. Thank you everyone for submitting your questions for Question of the Week. If you have a question that you would like us to answer in this segment of the show, please leave a comment down below on YouTube, or if you are listening on any of the audio platforms or apps, please fire us a DM on Instagram at Siege Studios or at Paint Perspective Podcast. This question comes from, once again, Grimdark Mark. Thank you, Grimdark Mark. You're really the banner bearer for Question of the Week at the minute. Step up your game, other listeners. Grimdark Mark says, "Hi team, it's me again. As a lover of the Grimdark settings of Warhammer and a huge Imperial Guard fan, and more recently the new Cities of Sigmar sculpts, my God, they're beautiful models. Your style is very much heavy metal from what I've seen, but how would you go about grimdarking your oh-so-crisp lines? Would you oil wash, new acrylic weathering medium? Let me know. All the best and love the show."
I will jump in if that's
okay. Yeah, because I can't do Mark's answer.
Well, you have. Your Nurgle model is grimdark. It's the Nurgle. It's got a darker feel to it, which is.
But I suppose, is this in like the context of Space Marines and armor chipping?
Rewind this. So basically, we've spoken about this a little bit on previous episodes. So there's this idea that to be grimdark, your model needs to be absolutely battered, covered in mud and rust and falling apart. And we've argued on the podcast that grimdark as a visual style is not necessarily conducive to that. So you can still paint a box art heavy metal style model and still have it feel very grimdark and very gritty.
It's a minimalist kind of...
It's also in the sense of like the color choices that you use. Correct, and how you approach painting the model in looking at it more of a atmospheric piece. So treating the model as a whole, maybe rather than individual panels.
Yeah, of course.
Looking at like glowing techniques and things like that. James, fire away.
So this has always been an interesting one for me. I think there's, as we mentioned, there's many different styles of execution, etc. But you can still approach them with your way of doing it and still have something that is in keeping with that style of execution, but just done in your level of approach. A good example of that is I've totally forgotten the painter. And I just want to say that now, just so I'm not being rude. I will get a picture of it flashed up on the wall there. This for me is a dreadnought that won at Golden Demon, and visually in the pictures when it was first seen, people were like, "Oh, that, what's so special about that?" Blah blah. Like I saw comments and things like that, and I was
already know the one you mean just from saying that.
Yeah, and I was like, number one, like you have to look at the model and thoroughly look at the model to understand the sheer level of effort that went into that model. Like every single bit of scratch or damage or chipping or grime or interest that's been applied to the sarcophagus and armature of that dreadnought has been done individually and had hours of investment put on it.
And with intention.
And with, yeah, with intent to give it that overall finish of the way that the model looks. The sheer skill that it takes to give a consistent random, like consistent and random are these two oxymorons. Yeah. Like we've had it before in classes where people get very, very much in the frame of mind of executing damage on a model and they'll cookie cutter the chip shape or the, because it's like that, oh, they're just in the zone of doing that.
Yeah, yeah.
So doing weathering over a whole entire model and making every single aspect of it look random, but with intent, obviously, of application because it's been put on there, is something that, quite frankly, like you need the most patience and the most controlled execution to do. Like, I think for our style of painting, and I say our style of painting in a very broad spectrum because, again, you know, box art style can be interpreted and been done in many different ways. But if we're talking strictly like heavy metal, for example, then colour choices are very important. I think that you really need to select a set of colours which are a bit more desaturated, a bit obviously darker. And I'm not trying to use a parody of the name, but a lot darker tones typically. But then
grim colours, you know.
Grim colours, yeah. In the same respect, you can also use saturated colours to insinuate certain things or to have certain, like, draw attention visually to make the person reading or looking at the model visually see something. So, for example, you could have a very dark overall miniature, but, for example, like, a light could be quite a saturated colour just to draw the eye and attention to that specific part of it. There's some of the best examples of that are, like, it's not even 40K, so it's, like, Mordheim. So, obviously, Grimdark comes from the man, the myth, the legend that is John Blanche, obviously, and all of his artwork and stuff. There were some amazing Mordheim miniatures back in the day where you'd have, like, a really sort of, like, desaturated, grim kind of looking, like, flagellant or someone like that, and then they have had like a brazier or something with some flames on it or something, you know. Like, there's some really good ways of approaching that style of painting from or that final execution, not style, sorry, that final execution of miniature, but with various different stylistic approaches. As I said, like, you can have a very refined, very clean in execution, not as in clean in overall the way that it looks and visually reads, but a clean execution whereby every single little bit has been decided upon with sheer intent, and that specific bit of chipping or scratching or streak or run or moisture around the rivet or subtle rusting on a certain area has all been decided.
Yeah.
Okay, we have our little closing tradition on the show called Hobby Hacks. This is where we share a little hobby hack with you that you can implement into your painting. Paul, you dropped the knowledge bomb of the sprue last week. So you've got quite a bar to uphold.
Well, this is, I mentioned a potato earlier. Obviously, there's no hack for the potato.
I'll tell you what you can do. You can practice drilling with a drill in a potato.
You can also.
Right, you're doing that thing where you just make up a nonsense hack off the cuff, no thought or regard, absolutely worthless.
Brown waffle. Yeah, but bonus paint perspective points if you practice your drilling in a potato.
There's a good sort of hack of involving slate in a bag.
Yeah, that was another great one.
Yeah, I'll just throw that in. Yeah.
That was a good hack. I'm standing by that one.
This question, I don't know if it's much as a hack, as more as a tip, I suppose. Especially from, like, coming from, I suppose, a beginner level, I guess. And that is, I'm sort of learning about contrast now, sort of, because I've always sort of highlighted and shaded colours using white in the mix or black in the mix. So that's totally fine. But you end up with kind of a muted colour version of that colour.
Or pastelised with white.
So I think sort of my sort of tip for this time is sort of be brave enough to use contrast, or push yourself to use contrast much higher than you usually would. So instead of...
Can we just clarify that you mean contrast is in the visual medium, not the paint.
No, forget the contrast paints, but as in the sort of the visual colour medium. So...
pushing colours to be brighter with bigger jumps than you might expect.
So rather than sort of adding white to you mix it for a highlight, try, like, for greens and things, try using like an elf flesh or an ice yellow in the mix, just to add something different to it. I would sort of suggest getting into color theory, because my goodness, color that's a whole nut, that's a whole another thing.
It's a deep rabbit hole. That's
So
quick 5-minute hack, just learn color theory.
Just learn color theory, take that away.
I mean, I was knocking George for sleep. I mean, that's a massive step up from that. Like, I mean, like,
for things like for shading, you don't have to use black or brown for shading. Use purple.
Yeah.
Use purple for shading. Mental, right? But it is so good. It's like I did a playground a little while ago, and I did my usual thing of, you know, Wraithbone undercoat, and then I gave the whole thing a purple. I think it was leash purple wash. I just washed the whole thing purple, and then did the green over the top. That was so much fun. I mean, it didn't really look that great at the end of it because the execution of it wasn't terribly great. And of course, it was an experiment sort of thing. But that process of just having some fun,
yeah,
and doing something, having a bit of a, just taking the time out every now and again to have a bit of an experiment with something. Yeah. Don't feel yourself sort of shoehorned in, I've got to do this, so I need to do this. But
on the contrast thing, I mean, Joe ridiculed me for this when I said it on the episode, but I do think it ties into your point, was it is right what you say, like pushing contrast to be brighter and bolder than you think it needs to be, because it does have that visual impact on a model that's so small.
It helps define the detail.
Yeah, when I was first painting, I was really, really going for smoothness. And in that, I would end up killing all of the contrast on the model.
Yeah.
I'd be trying to blend out the color difference. But what was the point of putting that brighter color on the model in the first place?
I would also suggest, like, if your model is sort of predominantly a certain color, say, I don't know, like a Death Guard Marine, like green or whatever, try doing the base as the opposite complement to that color on the color wheel. So if you, you know, say something that's mostly green, try doing some sort of groundwork that's sort of purple, kind of purple. Mm-hmm. So that's kind of the a nice sort of color contrast between the two there, and adds a bit of dynamicism. Is that the right word to use?
Yeah, between
the two things. And it just, I think that's just great, because I always just do my bases, you know, black with a gray dry brush or brown with a bit of a dry brush on it. It's not exactly visually interesting, but if you can sort of push yourself to use a little bit of more contrast than you're comfortable with, that's what I'd say. So like push yourself out of that comfort zone boundary that you sort of subconsciously force on yourself. Mm-hmm. It's sort of breaking through that and experimenting a little bit. So I would sort of say, have a painting session where you just go mental with colour.
I love that.
That's the best hobby hack ever. Just go mental with colour.
Just go mental with colour.
See, it's what I'm here for, really. Go mental with colours. Just go crazy with it. Well, instead of just doing a one colour base coat, say like purple as your base colour, do three. Just go mental and just do like three random colors in stripes over it, and then paint your model as you would normally and just see what that looks like.
Okay, well, on that note, thank you everyone for listening to this week's episode of Paint Perspective. If you could please support the show by doing all of the things like liking, subscribing to the channel, following us on Apple Podcasts or Spotify, liking the video, leaving a comment down below for question of the week. Thank you everyone. We will catch you next week.